Okay, great. Welcome, everyone. All right, welcome to our regular City Council meeting on Tuesday, May 22nd, 2018. For the record, all members of Council are present, and we'll call the meeting to order. And starting out, if we can all take a moment of silence, please. Thank you. And if we can all join us in the Pledge of Allegiance.
Ready to begin?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, we do have speaker slips in the back. I see some people looking at those, so we'll have speaker slips for all items on the agenda. Speaker slips for, and first up, we'll have public comment for items not on the agenda. But before we get there, we do have a couple other things. We've got recognition, which we don't have any tonight. Closed session report, none to report out, and mayor and council members' reports and announcements. And we'll start to the right, Ms. McPherson.
Well, this is the final announcement I'm going to make about the Kent Nagano concert, which is June 8th, 7 o'clock at St. Timothy's Church. And if you want tickets, go to mbopenspace.org. There's still some available. Thanks. Friday the 8th.
Moving down the line, good evening. Councilmember McPherson and I will be hosting a vacation rental ordinance review input session with the community. We've set a date for June the 20th, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at the community center. And if you have ideas about what should be included, that will be an open forum. There will not be a three-minute limitation. We'll give you maybe 3.5 minutes or depending on how many people are there. But it will be a time to give further input. We'll have a first draft of the ordinance. Scott will be joining us. Mr. Graham will be with us. And we just love to have you come out and give your input on that specific ordinance as that's developed. So we are a subcommittee of the council and really want to hear what the community has to say.
Date and time again? That is the
20th of June, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at the community center.
Okay. Matt. Red?
I went to the police station last Friday afternoon to buy a T-shirt, and Macy went into the back to find Bonnie Johnson to get the T-shirt. She came back, and she said, Bonnie said you'll have to come back on Monday. And she said, A grandmother had just called in from Del Mar Park, and she was putting on a birthday party for her grandson and his friends, and they all wanted to ride their bikes from Del Mar Park to the bike park. So Bonnie had gotten on the police bike and was on her way over to escort them. And I looked out the glass door, and there goes Sergeant Canby, the watch commander, on her bicycle to join them. And I thought, this is why I love Morro Bay. So that's all I have.
All right, Red. Great story. A couple of announcements and thank yous. First, I wanted to thank the chief for putting together the law enforcement memorial that took place last Thursday. And regretfully, I couldn't make that, but I also want to extend my thanks to you and all your team and the city staff that assisted in that, and Mayor Pro Tem Marlis McPherson, who was the representative for the city. And so I just want to give a thanks for that. Thank you very much. And then I had spoken about a code of civility signing that the There's a mayor's meeting of all the mayors in the county once a month, and there was initiated that there would be a code of civility, kind of a regional signing, and there's been some discussion on that, and I talked about that at the last announcement. The draft has been finalized, and on June 21st, there's going to be a regional signing. And one of my comments at the mayor's meeting when this was going on, which I think it's great that, you know, all the cities are talking about that, is that, you know, as mayors, we get to discuss various things, but, you know, I wanted to make sure that it was much more inclusive than mayor signing, and so I want to make sure that, to extend, you know, to the rest of council and anybody in the audience to join in that, and I'll make sure I get an email out to council. But it's on June 21st, and the location was to be determined, but I'll make sure I get that to council, and then would eventually like to agendize that and bring it back for council endorsement. I know we have a code of civility that we have adopted, but this would just be an endorsement of what the county assigned. So that's an announcement there. And then finally, we had one of our fine members in the community that was given an award recently, and oh, there's the picture right there. On the right, there on the left, there's Matt and John, Matt Makweski and John Taylor, and this is an award that took place. See, it's a small town, so you meet people in the coffee shop, and they tell you things that go on that you might not have known. But the county has what's called Access for All, and I'll read you what that means. In San Luis Obispo County, people with disabilities vote, shop, work, play, and celebrate advances made in disability advocacy by the enduring efforts of local, regional, and national leaders. In the past, people with disabilities were routinely excluded from community activities that most of us take for granted, going to school, a store, a park, a church, a sporting event, or just getting out of a house, or more often, an institution, was just a dream. Physical and attitudinal barriers were pervasive. Barriers to full participation are dissolving as more people realize that we are all temporarily able-bodied. What we do to improve the quality of life for people with disabilities benefits us all, the elderly, veterans, children, and families. Since 2001, Access for All volunteers and community partners have been at the forefront of efforts to create a more accessible San Luis Obispo County. You can visit www.sloaccessforall.org to learn more about the local disability advocacy activities and resources. The Access for All Endowment is held at the Community Foundation San Luis Obispo. The goal is to raise a minimum of $200,000 as an enduring fund dedicated to the inclusion for all people with disabilities, and there's an advisory board that meets monthly to discuss ways in which they can promote accessibility in the county. So this is an annual event, and John Taylor and our very own council member Matt Makowiecki were giving the business category award for Project Surf Camp. Project Surf Camp is a charitable organization designated to educate individuals with special needs. Their mission is to build self-confidence, self-esteem, and self-efficacy. We further provide opportunities to build social skills, improve physical fitness, develop healthy outlets for stress reduction, and foster independence. John Taylor and Matt Makowiecki, Project Surf Camp is unique in that there is no other similar adaptive surf program in the county. John and Matt's special education experience plus the formation of a very structured program is key to serving such a large number of special needs individuals. So, Matt, you were awarded this this award through Access for All, and I think it's fitting to recognize you at the council meeting. Thanks for you and John and all your work and founding this this great program. So, thanks. Surprise. Sorry, John. John wasn't able to attend. Okay, with that, we move on to next items on the agenda. As I get to speaker slips, let me just go through those. This is for all items not on the agenda.
Mayor.
And then, yes, sir.
Can I make a brief announcement?
Okay, excuse me.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank
That'd be
you.
Perfect as I look through these speaker slips.
No
Thanks.
Problem.
Thank you.
All right. I just wanted to bring it to attention in the community, the utility discount program.
Okay. Thanks.
Which is nearly one of a kind for our county. It's a very important program that has limited visibility, I would say, and limited reach with our community. But ultimately, what this program is about is providing a discount to our water and sewer bill ratepayers, those who are income qualified through the existing PG&E Care and SoCal Gas Care programs, which help folks who are on limited or fixed income. At this point, the program provides a 10% discount, which can go a long way to helping people be able to afford rates, and particularly in light of the potential for the anticipated rate increase associated with the WRF program. So we just wanted to make sure that this was available, that folks had this information before them, because open enrollment for the program begins on July 1st. So we want to give folks plenty of time to sign up with PG&E Care program, because that saves us a lot of administrative costs, which allows us to put more of that money back into rate savings. So we just wanted to make sure that was known. We're going to do everything we can to get this information out as far as possible. So we encourage people to post this on Nextdoor and other channels to make sure that their neighbors are aware of the program. In addition, and related to this, the City Council will be hosting a special meeting on June 13th, which will primarily be WRF related. And this is to give a comprehensive update and to discuss kind of a lot of the important components of the project. We'll probably also be hosting another community workshop sometime in the very near future as well. And once we have all those dates solidified, we'll make sure that that gets out to the public as soon as possible. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thanks. And with that, we'll move on to our next item on the agenda. I've got speaker slips for public comment for items not on the agenda. And then following the general public comment period, we have consent, which we also have public comment period for, and we have three business items, and we'll have a public comment for all those. If there's an item later on the agenda that you may not be able to stay for, you're welcome to come up during the general comment period, and I just ask that you submit that and or speak to that item for later. With that, we open up with our business spot, and tonight we have Judy Forster from Sunny Catering, and she's our business spot for tonight. Welcome, Judy.
Thank you. I'd like to start by saying thank you to the City Council and the City of Mobay and Mayor Jamie Irons for inviting 63 and Sunny Catering to this presentation this evening. I'm Judy Forster, and this is my daughter, True Forster. We recently joined the Morro Bay Chamber of Commerce and are excited to be able to share our business with you. We're located in Cayucas, and it's predictably 63 and sunny there on a regular basis, and that's how we came up with our catering name. I have always had a passion for locally grown, raised, and prepared foods, and love cooking since I was a little girl. I've enjoyed working in the food and event planning industry most of my life. I have hosted many parties and events and approached and organizing many events as well. Cooking for a large gathering of people comes naturally to me. I love to share my cooking style and help educate and introduce everyone to our farm-to-table experience, grown and prepared right here in the Central Coast. We source the majority of our products within a 50-mile radius. This ensures the freshest foods and also keeps our economy right here in San Luis Obispo County. From the small storefronts and vendors, as well as the ranchers, farmers, and fishermen. I decided to launch my own catering company in 2016, a boutique catering business highlighting the year-round bounty of food and resources of the Central Coast. Boutique, meaning we cater to smaller, more intimate events, parties, weddings, and so forth. This also allows us to showcase the difference in locally sourced, fresh, and in-season foods and you can taste the difference. Every event is special to us, being customized and personalized to each client's needs and requests. Our pricing is competitive with the local restaurants, and since we don't have a storefront or the same overhead as a brick and mortar, we are able to customize and make each event an individual experience at the local, at the location of the client's choice. There's a lot more intimacy and attention given by having a private gathering for your friends and family. There are pamphlets and business cards for you to take. Some have been distributed, some are in the back. And they will direct you to our website, our Facebook page, and our Yelp reviews. Please feel free to take a few, share them with your friends and family. Consultations are free, and so are sample menus. And I would like to say thank you for your time and attention and inviting us to share our business with you. We also have graduation coming up soon, so if anybody is looking for a nice graduation dinner at their home instead of going out, we're we have our website has a schedule and calendar on it. So thank you for letting us come and present. Let's make your event delicious. Thank you.
Thank you, Judy. And with that, we'll open up public comment. First up is Rigmore, and then we have Ken Green.
Good evening, City. Good evening, Mr. Mayor, City Council. I have no paper today, so this will probably be a mess. But I was told about 15 minutes ago I better go down here because you guys are ready to close off Surf Street stairs because you're too cheap to put in a couple of $1,000s in some good bolts and a couple of wood pieces for the stairs. You don't live over here, so you don't know that every morning, every afternoon, all day long, there are people walking, getting down those stairs, some people running, some with their dogs, and when we have events, it is all day long. It's wonderful. I mean, even Matt is running around, and Marlis, and Jen, and I've even seen Livick. You know, it's an open street, it's very visible, it's a great place, and I mean, we're all happy people here, and they all wave to us. We're going to just miss the heck out of it, you know. But these stairs are more used and more freely down to the Embarcadero than the stairway over at Tidelands Park, the Centennial Stairway. If you had a clicker sitting there seeing how many people really enjoy this, and when we have events, they ask, where are the stairs going down to the Embarcadero? So I think you should think, the person told me that someone had said 300,000 or something to build. You know, we agree. We shouldn't be wasting money. We don't want to waste money. But if we're spending millions on sewer projects, which we all actually like, we don't like the money, but, you know, we're happy for it. Anyway, so, you know, they don't have to be perfect. Just keep them going. I went down there the other day, and they are a little scary for people with bad hips and bad knees because I went to the event for the Coast Guard, which, of course, was the most amazing event I've been to because I love the playing of the horns and the people in their uniforms. It's the best event I've been to in Morro Bay. It was just amazing. See, I'm nearly getting tears just thinking about it. Anyway, just think about it. Those stairs are very important. We know there's one woman, I'm not going to mention name, that don't want to see anybody walking by there, but you shouldn't just stop it because of maybe someone's agenda. So, since I have no paper, I'm really going to thank you guys. I think you're just so darn awesome. The work you're putting into this and your staff, amazing people. Even the manager, I'm starting to think is okay. Because I really liked Buckingham. So, I mean, I wasn't quite sure when
thank you, Rigmore.
This guy. So, thank you all. And good luck.
Thanks, Rigmore. Eric Four. Excuse me, Ken Green. I'm sorry. Ken Green and then Eric Four. Thanks. Sorry about that. I got one ahead of myself. You guys are great.
Yeah, it was all teed up.
Yeah, you are. Yeah. Thank you.
Mr. Mayor, City Council, staff. Well, I'm one of those people who uses the stairs every day, too, so add one more person. I'm here not to complain, believe it or not. I'm here to offer a good deal of praise and thanks. So, echoing the comments about the police ceremony last Tuesday, I rarely see strong men cry, but I'm maybe not the strongest man, and I am not going to be able to read what I have down here, but really an impressive ceremony all the way through, and the city pulled together the departments nicely, the fire department with its flag, and the harbor patrol with the fire boats, and council member pro tem mayor McPherson giving her thing, and Chief Allen conducting a ceremony like nothing I've ever seen before. So, well done. Okay. Second thing, city reports. Thank you to Scott Collins for the frequent reports on what the city manager is up to and his perceptions of things. Thank you to Jennifer Calloway for the updates on the financial happenings in the town. I don't know if you've received much feedback about those, but really well-deserved, very thorough, and nobody yet, I guess, is asking questions, but I suppose you can expect them sooner or later. In any event, this is a thank you, and very happy to see them. Okay, the third item deals with the water reclamation facility, and it's not a complaint. It's just everybody's anxious to know what the bids were. So if you could shed some light on what technicalities you're facing before making things public, that would be appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you, Ken. Eric Four, and then Pam Oakes.
Good evening, Mayor and Council. I'm Eric Four, Morro Bay resident. Tonight, I'd like to take 3 minutes to outline a 9-point plan that would be more cost-effective than the South Bay sewer proposal. I think of this plan as a staged retreat, with the first stage being built as soon as is necessary, and the final and most expensive stage being built in 100 years or never. This plan will meet the requirements of both the Coastal Commission and the Water Board. First, if he will agree, open a dialogue with Mr. Barry Brannon. Much but not all of the following plan was inspired by his ideas. Second, institute a program of repairing our underground sewer pipes. Repair the largest and most damaged pipes first. This will improve our current plant's capabilities and provide evidence to the Water Board that we are working on a solution. Three, after the worst pipes are fixed and the Cayucas population has left our system, re-examine the discharge. Employ at least 2 independent labs to take new measurements. Determine how much more improvement is actually required. If more treatment is necessary, then proceed as follows. Keep the existing sewer plant in place and in operation. Upgrade it to the full extent that we are allowed by the Coastal Commission. Increase its cleaning schedule. Maximize its capabilities and improve odor abatement. Design concrete and steel compartments sealed by watertight hatches and covers to make it tsunami resistant. 5. Direct the plant's discharge through a new underground pipe as far up the Morro Creek Valley as is necessary. 6. Terminate this discharge pipe at a new, smaller auxiliary treatment plant B to finish the treatment process away from the restrictions of the Coastal Commission and the complaints from citizens. 7. The finished discharge from plant B could be directed into the ocean outfall or injected into the Morro Creek aquifer, far enough east of our city wells to provide for filtration. 8. Plant B should be sized to handle a maximum output of plant A. The design should be expandable in the event that Seawater may someday decommission our existing Plant A. In other words, we should plan to retreat, but let's do so in an orderly and cost-effective fashion. 9. Water injection into the Morro Creek aquifer will increase the probability of flooding in the Morro Creek flood zone during the wet months. Therefore, we should install a sump pump station in this zone to remove excessive high water under flood conditions. We could direct the discharge of this pump out through our existing ocean outfall. This concept would protect every structure in the flood zone, including the existing sewer plant, the Morro Bay High School, the businesses on Atascadero Road and Main Street, and the entire Embarcadero business community. Thank you. If you like, I'll leave a copy of this for your consideration.
Thanks. Thank you, Eric. Pam Oakes, and then Aaron Oakes.
Hi, Pam Oakes with SaveMorroBay.com. The bids came in for the wastewater project on May 8th. It's now May 22nd. Where are the bids? Why are you hiding the numbers the community has been waiting for so long now? How long does it take you to spin it? We keep hearing from this council about the project being so large, so huge, making it so overpriced. Or like you said tonight, this is a small town, Little Morro Bay. Mr. Levick said this project will have offices with 17 employees, and that's just crazy. The contract for Corolo for up to $7 million before the next 218 vote is just crazy. Having only the two largest companies bid and both having a conflict of interest is crazy. Adding water reclamation, which is making the project completely unaffordable, is just crazy. If you were just adding $5 more a month for reclamation, that would make sense. But adding 60, 70, who knows how much more, especially when we have a desal plant and state water. So that's crazy. This council said it needed reclamation for a federal loan, and that's nuts too. As I said before, if it wasn't a grant from the feds, we only need the state revolving fund loan, which has a lower interest rate than the WIFIA anyway. Your so-called April study session was really a scare session, having the water bird come in threatening fines if the 218 protest was successful. The city's management of this project is more than just crazy, much more. I spoke with the chief executive officer at the Regional Water Board about this, and he wasn't even aware that we had already had a 218 in 2015 for $75 million. You didn't tell him. He's having their attorney look at the meeting and what Harvey Packer said regarding the 218 protest and fines. The Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association says something was not legal about what Harvey Packer said. The property owners have the right to exercise their constitutional right to protest the sewer rate increase. The State Water Board in Sacramento was very surprised to hear about Harvey Packard's threats and the high price tag of the project for just over 10,000 people. According to the Coastal Commission, Morro Bay is the only city in the state that has been asked to move their plant inland, and we're leading the way for other towns to move inland. Why and at what cost does Morro Bay have to lead the way? Okay, that's it. Thanks.
Thank you, Pam. Aaron Oakes.
Good evening, members of the council and staff. My name is Aaron Oakes of Save Morro Bay. First off, I want to thank a few members of our city staff for hosting the last Wednesday's presentation, the Q&A informational session. I want to thank our city manager, Mr. Collins, Public Works Director, Mr. Livick, and our new program manager, Mr. Ceceris, for answering questions. But the problem that I had was that the city struggled to answer the most basic questions about the water reclamation facility. When asked why there were only two bidders for the project, who just so happened to be global engineering firms that typically design projects over $100 million, Mr. Live explained that only big companies can bid on such a big project. What Livick didn't mention was, and I'll use his language, one of the big bidders also helped author the facility's master plan, which the city commissioned for $800,000. That facility's master plan made the project even bigger for a very small city. When he was asked why 17 alternative sites were considered, but not projects, Mr. Livick replied nonsensically that every technology goes through the same wastewater treatment process, that there is no silver bullet of ideal technology. And I was pulling up on my phone while he was answering the question. His response was almost word for word from a Wikipedia page on sewer treatment. That's kind of embarrassing. When he was asked about how the money was spent from the 2015 Prop 218 vote for the wastewater project, he said the money voters approved was spent. First, he said the money was accumulated. Then he said the money was spent on capital improvement projects that weren't necessarily sewer related. He said water, sewer, but he didn't specify what those projects were. I was wondering, is one of those projects maybe the collection system that the city knew since 2002 was a problem and leaking into our groundwater supply? Was that one of the projects? Wasn't sure. So that's a thing. We only hear Mr. Livick's word. We don't actually have a paper trail of the accounting from 2015 of the monies voters approved. So I call on the City Council to hire an independent auditor for the money ratepayers approved in 2015 for $75 million. Why should we trust the city when they can't show accounting records for the past 3 years? We can't trust Mr. Livick's word alone because that would be a big mistake. Thank you.
Marla, thanks, Aaron. Marla Jo Sadowski. And then Brad Snook.
Hi. Marla Jo Sadowski, North Morro Bay. I wanted to put something on the overhead, but it's broken, and what I wanted to put on there is the Water Reclamation Facility Public Forum Notice of Special Meeting for 425. I've asked that the city pull the Agenda A2 from the calendar and have a discussion on that before you approve those minutes. There is a significant portion of what occurred at that meeting that was unseen and unheard, and it has to do with procedure. I'd like to begin reading something here. That meeting, which I was talking about, the 425, the meeting had one agenda item, which was Water Reclamation Facility Public Forum. Review project history, project status, and next steps. Invited regulatory agency presentations. Question and answer period facilitated by the League of Women Voters. In violation of the Brown Act, the agenda did not provide the legally required opportunity for the public to speak on this item. California Brown Act Section 54954.3A says, every notice for a special meeting shall provide an opportunity for members of the public to directly address the legislative body concerning any item that has been described in the notice for the meeting before or during consideration of that item. At the April 25, 2018 special council meeting, the public was not allowed to speak. Instead, the city required meeting attendees to submit written questions that were read aloud by an outside facilitator after the presentations were complete. I personally brought this Brown Act violation to the attention of a council member, the city manager, and the city attorney. They ignored the information and allowed the meeting to proceed without any opportunity for public comment. I am confident that we all understand that submitting written questions before a meeting and to be possibly read at the meeting by someone else is not the same thing as speaking. To add insult to injury, at the April 25 meeting, many of the written questions, including mine and those of several other residents I have spoken to, were not read and addressed, and some questions were edited by the moderator, making this Brown Act violation even more egregious. Questions received and censored by the League of Women Voters cannot substitute for the public's right to directly address the mayor and city council. The city's serious and blatant violation of the Brown Act at the April 25 special city council meeting not only illegally denied members of the public their right to speak and participate, it prevented those attending and remotely viewing the meeting from seeing the true nature, scope, and depth of residents' opposition to the wharf project approach favored by the city. In doing so, it turned the meeting into what is essentially a city propaganda tool that many of us believe has been very purposely aimed at defeating the Proposition 218
protest
vote.
Thank you, Marla. Thank you. Next is Brad Snook.
Good evening, Council. I'm Brad Snook. I'm the chair of our county's chapter of Surfrider Foundation. I'm also the program coordinator for Know Your H2O in our county. I brought for the council a copy of our comments on the draft EIR for the WRF. A couple of concerns that we had in the draft EIR had to do with the protection of cultural resources. Ask the city work as much as possible to make sure that any disturbances having to do with all the pipelines and new infrastructure be as protective as those resources as possible. We also ask that because of the remaining infrastructure that will be in a 100-year floodplain and also a tsunami run-up zone, that a redundancy project be created on the downgrade side of the pump station in the form of a constructed wetland. And that could be on the existing wastewater treatment plant site. It would offer a coastal component built into what is a coastal zone, and I think that will help to kind of replace some of the impacts having to do with carbon burial. Also, some of the brine discharge to ocean outfall could be redirected into the wetland to help recharge the aquifer. The open space would serve the city for years to come. Replacing what is an industrial facility with open space and a very functional, natural purpose of a constructed wetland. You'll find that the Sierra Club and a co-keeper signed on the letter with us. You'll also find contact information if you want to reach out to Gordon or Mr. Christie or myself. Thank you.
Thank you, Brad. That concludes our public comment period. And there's some points as far as the WRF bids. There's some comments about the anxiousness of response to those, and maybe we can respond to that and what that procedure is going to be.
Sure. Let me clarify. We did not receive any bids for the wharf project. We received two proposals in response to RFP. We are going through the California Public Contracts Code process for design-build, which requires us to use a two-step process, select the most qualified proposer. Once we select that most qualified proposer, we will ask council to endorse that and proceed with negotiations for their guaranteed maximum final guaranteed maximum price. Those proposals did include a cost component. The city should not be put in a position of negotiation with the final selected proposer with them having knowledge of the other proposer's costs to ensure that we get the lowest price possible. Once this is completed, we'll bring the full cost to council for their endorsement and authorization to execute a contract.
Okay. Thanks for that clarification.
I'd anticipate the process to go through the Water Reclamation Citizens Advisory Committee sometime in mid-June and come to council near the end of June.
Okay.
Can I just add that council does not know the bids? We have not seen anything yet, so we are in the dark as the rest of the citizens with respect to these proposals.
Any other responses or anything like that out there? None? Okay, we'll move on. Next up on the agenda is consent, and I've got two public speaker comments for consent. For item A2, Marla Jo, for the consent calendar, consent agenda, and then Betty Winholtz.
I am Marla Jo Breton-Sadowski, North Morro Bay. I am interested in the council continuing the approval process for these minutes, and because I believe that they do not they don't capture what happened and what didn't happen. In this case, usually the minutes describe the actions of the council, and I would suggest that in this case the minutes do need to correctly specify the inaction of the council, beginning with the fact that you weren't convened in a body. You were dispersed amongst the audience. There was no public comment on the agenda item, which is supposed to be on there. So when I came in and there was no speaker podium, and you weren't here to address. So I had a concern, an objection, and I wanted to make that objection publicly, at least, to the proceeding. I was not allowed to do that. I spoke with the city attorney, I spoke with the city manager, and I spoke with one of the city council members, trying to assert the right for the public to have public comment at that meeting. In addition, there's as far as the minutes to this meeting go, I believe that the written questions that were submitted by the public to the League of Women Voters, which the city lost custody of those public records and had to get them back from the League of Women Voters, they're retrieved and they're back in the custody of the city. I would ask that those written questions from the attendees at the meeting be attached to the meeting minutes for 4/25/18. The YouTube video does not show the questions. It does not show the true nature of what the audience was thinking and feeling. The questions that the League of Women Voters did, they sort, they edit, in essence, they censor. All of the questions weren't read. There was a time limit. I don't know if the city imposed the time limit at 2 hours. This was the whole thing I think on the minutes it says that the staff present was the city attorney, the city manager, the public works director.
Thank you, Marla.
They were on the panel, on the WRF panel.
Thank you. Betty Winholtz.
I'm Betty Winholtz, and I want to speak to A6, which is the request by People's Self-Help Housing to ask for $75,000 for their project that's been in existence, I think, at least 10 years over on Sequoia Street. People's Self-Help Housing has been a very good friend to Morro Bay and put in a lot of housing for us, manages a lot of housing for us. I think that if they're asking for $75,000, that that's not a lot of money in light of how we spend other kinds of money. And this is for a very important upgrade. They've done a beautiful job on the senior housing behind Spencer's. They've upgraded the apartments down on Main Street. And I, when we have almost $300,000 in that fund, I'm feeling that we can afford to give them the $75,000. It's not like it's coming out of the general fund or somewhere else. It's already dedicated, and it could be go to them. And I would encourage you to raise that amount from the recommended $50,000 to the requested $75,000.
Thanks, Betty. Daria Orzi? Sorry, I knew I was going to butcher that, but maybe you can pronounce it for me. Daria.
Orizi.
Orizi.
Daria Orizi with People Self-Help Housing. Thank you, City Council and Mayor. Just like to say thank you for the opportunity for the in lieu dollars for our rehabilitation project at Sequoia. We're very thankful to rehab that project and continue the work that we do in this county and the city. And thank you very much.
Any response to the requested amount? As recommended from
no,
staff?
No, we're happy with the amount that's been in the staff report that staff has requested the $50,000.
Okay.
Of course, $75,000 would be great as well, but we're happy to take anything that you guys can help us out with.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thanks. And with that, that concludes our public comment for consent, and bring it back to council. Any items to pull on consent from council?
A6.
We have A6. Anything else? No? Okay. We'll pull item A6, and then I'll take a motion.
I move all items except for A6.
We have a motion.
Second.
A motion by Mr. Davis, second by Mr. Makowetzki. And any discussion? None? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None. Motion carries 5-0. Item A6. Mr. Heading?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I just wanted to pull that item. Thank you, Ms. Winholtz, for bringing the concern forward. I just had a question for staff. Was there a specific reason with regard to the amount that we have in the fund that the allocation of $50,000 was recommended as opposed to $75,000? Just curious.
I'm not going to answer the question. I'm going to have Ms. Jason, our senior planner,
answer.
Can you explain why? I think it would be helpful for us.
So normally I would answer the question.
Yes, thanks.
But the item involves, I sit on the commission for the Housing Trust Fund, San Luis Obispo, and we provide funding opportunities for projects like this. Specifically, this is one of the ones in the mix that I vote on.
Okay.
And so didn't want to have the perceived conflict of interest,
yep.
And so I've had Cindy deal with this issue entirely. So
yeah, thank you. I just felt it necessary to explain, and thank you for doing that.
I didn't know that. And
yeah.
So thank you, and I did say staff. So
yeah,
staff. Thank you, Cindy. Just again, the question is why 50 versus 75, and.
Certainly. So staff recommendation is for the $50,000 based on department priorities. Community Development Department will be updating its housing element. Currently, our housing element is 2014 to 2019, and we'll be looking to update that next year. And so we'll be looking for that affordable housing in lieu balance to fund that. We last updated it in 2014, and it'll be due again. And then in addition, the size of the in-lieu balance is appears to be a little bit high right now, but as I identified in the staff report, the city did get a large deposit just recently due to a development that's under construction, and we do not anticipate any future increases or deposits to in lieu this fiscal year or next.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Sure.
Did you have a follow-up question?
Any other questions?
I did. Actually, I was going to pull this item, too. I sent some questions to Cindy earlier, and I just thought, for the record, I asked, is it fairly common that we would extend the date of a loan to the city? Because it seemed like quite a long time to extend the loan, and I was just asking about that, if you could respond to that.
Sure. So the funding for this project, similar to the Ocean View Manor apartments, which Ms. Winholtz identified in her public comments, it's funded by the State Tax Credit Allocation Committee, and it's very standard for affordable housing developments to deed restrict the properties for a term of 55 years, essentially making it permanently affordable. And then in exchange, applicants often seek local match from local jurisdictions, and because the city will be required to subordinate those loans to the first lender, it's consistent with that funding from the state.
And so I'm correct that People's Self-Help Housing is seeking a grant, actually, to do the renovation. Is that correct? And we're just essentially providing a match.
Right. A layperson could technically characterize it as a grant, but in the financial vernacular, it would be considered a 0% residual receipts loan. So essentially, yeah, it's a grant.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, that's quite the description. Any other discussion or questions at this point? None? Thanks, Cindy. So any more discussion from council?
No, just I'll just summarize. I was going to pull it also because of the fact that I wanted to recognize People's Self-Help Housing for the great job that they do, not only in our community but across the county and many other areas, and just give them a shout-out and recognition for the great job that you folks do. We really appreciate this. You're addressing this very important issue and us being able to partner with you. With that, I would move, hearing that explanation, staff's recommendation to authorize $50,000 of affordable housing in lieu funds for the Sequoia Street Apartment rental housing development at 365-389 Sequoia Street and restatement of existing CDBG and in lieu funds.
Second.
We have a motion by Mr. Henning, second by Ms. McPherson. Any further discussion? None. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None. Motion carries 5-0. Okay, thanks. And then moving on, we've got our first business item, and item C1. And this is the review and provide comment on the One Water Plan and provide direction as deemed appropriate. And this is a Public Works item. Mr. Livick, you're going to introduce this item?
Yes, I am. And then we also have Ms. Hansen. Damaris Hansen is here to help us answer questions. Eric Caceres from Corollo Engineers will be presenting a brief presentation. We did receive some questions in the run-up to this item that we'll incorporate as much as possible into the presentation, and then we can have follow-up afterwards. We did, late in the day, email some of those responses back to council, but it was pretty late in the afternoon, like 10 minutes before the budget meeting. So not sure if you had a chance to digest those questions. Anyway, this item is coming to you based upon fulfillment of one of our city council goals on the WRF/OneWater program. And the portion that we'll be focusing on tonight is the update of our CIP lists for both water and sewer. Great deal of detail on the first 5 years with extended going out to 20 years with a little bit less detail. I'm going to bring Eric up to commence the presentation, and following the presentation, answering questions, turning over to the public for public comment, and then further direction by City Council. Thank you. Eric?
Thanks, Rob. Mr. Mayor, Council, City Staff, Eric Caceres with Grohl Engineers. Really, this is an update. I think the last time we came and presented on this item was back in January. To give you an idea of where we were with this process, it started back in the late summer of last year with the development of the One Water Plan. As Rob mentioned, we're going to focus on, we're kind of nearing the end of the One Water Plan, and we want to focus tonight on really the water and sewer capital improvement program that has come out of the analysis that we've done, and there's good reason for that, as I'll explain as we move forward here. Again, we did receive a lot of questions from members of council, and so I'll try to hit as many of those as I can remember as we go through, but please, if I don't, please feel free to ask those questions after I conclude the presentation or during the presentation, for that matter. So just to bring everybody back to this, the One Water concept and why we're doing the analysis in this way. we lost the presentation for a second here. The city has been doing infrastructure planning efforts for many years. And the new concept in the industry is to kind of look at the water infrastructure and water resources as a whole holistically. And so the city made the decision to do this last year and to do infrastructure planning, looking at all the water distribution system, the collection system, and the stormwater system, as well as looking at the water supply, the future water supply for the city. And again, this is something that others in California, or others in the nation for that matter, are embracing and doing their own kind of One Water exercises. One Water LA is a big one that was recently completed. And so this is kind of the industry, how the industry is moving forward and looking at their water infrastructure. Really, the goals and objectives for the One Water Plan is really first and foremost is to identify the capital improvements necessary to maintain the health of the city's water, sewer, and storm systems. That's a very important piece of it. The next piece that, again, we're going to focus on at a future meeting is really looking at the city's future water supply portfolio and options for diversifying that portfolio in the future. Really, part of the goal of this is to inform the general plan and the local coastal plan updates. And then also to, as a kind of a broader picture, is also to inform the WRF program and the rate study that's ongoing for the WRF program and potential rate increase, because all of these things need to be captured within that kind of combined water and sewer bill that folks are interested in. So in terms of tonight, what we're really going to focus on, the progress that we've made on the water distribution and collection system sides and the capital improvement programs that have come out of that. And I have my little tablet here, kind of a cheat sheet, looking at the same thing that you guys have in your agenda package in terms of some of the detail on the capital improvement program. So if you have questions on individual projects, I should be able to call those up. So first we'll focus on the water distribution system. And as we mentioned back in January, this water, the water distribution master plan really consists of a lot of components. We started off the end of last summer doing a lot of data gathering and analysis, and we had to construct a model of the city's existing water distribution system essentially from scratch. There's information in GIS, but we had to create that model within our modeling software. We did an analysis of both current and future anticipated water demands, and we talked about that at length when we met here in January. And then we go through the modeling effort. We construct the model, and then we use a number of different tools to calibrate that model, so we have confidence that essentially what's happening out there in the field, as they say, is really being depicted by the model itself. And so it's a good representation of what's actually happening. And then what we do is we run the model through a number of different scenarios to try to find deficiencies within the system. We find those deficiencies, and then we come up with options for correcting those deficiencies, come up with costs, and then those costs are programmed into a capital improvement program through the year 2040. I should have mentioned that earlier, but the One Water Plan is essentially looking from now through the year 2040, so it's about a 22-year planning horizon. So really the evaluation starts with the model. We're going to kind of pick up here with our calibrated model because that's kind of where we left off in January. So we have a calibrated model of the system, which the green dots there represent all of the various demands within the city. So that's where we're starting off is with the calibrated model. And then we go through and we do our evaluation. And so the city has five different pressure zones in its water distribution system. And so we have to look at these individual pressure zones in as they relate to pumping capacity, storage, and other aspects. So we really look at them kind of individually. We've got the upper and lower King zone, the Elena zone, the Nutmeg zone, the Blanca zone, and the Ridgeway zone. And these things will come up as we discuss some of the specific projects that we identified or deficiencies that we identified. So I wanted to just highlight that. So the system is now evaluated under several different flow conditions. This goes back to some of the questions that we receive about when we're talking about deficiency, what does that mean? How are we evaluating evaluating the city's distribution system, et cetera? So we really look at three conditions. We look at the average day demand. We look at the peak hour demand, and we look at the maximum day demand plus fire flow. So just to go back, what do some of these terms mean? Essentially, the average day demand is kind of the average daily demand over the average of the year. So you average every day of the year, and that's the average day demand. The maximum day demand is essentially the highest water demand on the highest demand day of the year. And then the peak hour is that peak hour during that max demand day. So it's absolute most it's the most stringent condition that the system is going to see over the course of the year. So pressure criteria that we use to evaluate the system are consistent with industry standards. So a couple questions were asked about, you know, how did we come up with some of these numbers? Typically, when you look at that peak hour demand, you want your system to be to maintain a pressure, have a residual pressure of above 40 PSI. So that's one criteria that we look at. And then the maximum day demand condition plus fire flow. We'll talk a little bit about fire flow analysis and some of the efficiencies we found in the system as they relate to fire flow. But if you're at that maximum day condition and you have a fire, you want to make sure that you have a 20% or 20 PSI residual pressure in your system. And that's an important criteria and accepted criteria by most cities and agencies that do these studies. And then at the average day demand, we want to make sure that we're not exceeding maximum pressure. So we like to look at about 120 PSI as the maximum pressure that we see in the system. We also look at pipeline velocities. And so that's another question that we had is how do we determine if a pipeline is deficient? We look at velocity. So we're trying to carry too much water through a given pipeline of a certain size. And so for existing pipelines, we use 8 feet per second at the peak hour condition. But what we do is we use a less stringent planning criteria for new infrastructure. So we don't want to stress the new infrastructure as much. And we also want a little bit more of a lenient criteria for existing facilities because we want to, we're always walking that fine line between identifying, you know, if deficiencies that really exist versus being overly conservative and identifying too many deficiencies, which is why we kind of separate out the new versus the old infrastructure and the way we look at things. We also look at pumping capacity, and really that considers the planning criteria that we use really looks at redundancy. So when we're looking at the various booster pump stations that are located within the city's distribution system, we want to make sure that those pump stations have the ability to pump the maximum day demand with one pump out of service, and we call that firm capacity essentially. So total capacity is what's your pump station capacity with every single pump running. Firm capacity is what's the capacity with the largest pump out of service. So that's how that's what we use to look at the pumping facilities within the distribution system. We developed fire flow criteria with staff and reviewed those with the fire department, and this is a list of the different fire flow requirements by zone. Again, this was something that we this varies kind of from city to city. We worked with the city to develop these and then had these blessed by the fire department, and this is what went into our fire flow analysis that I'll talk a little bit about. And then storage, probably the most visible piece of the distribution system. There's really three pieces of storage that we look at. We kind of have the operational and equalization storage, that storage that gets used every single day. We have a fire flow storage that we plan for, and then we also have an emergency storage. So we worked with staff to develop criteria the criteria that we wanted to use to evaluate the different tanks that the city has in its distribution system and recommend improvement. So first, that operation, that operational or equalization storage volume is about is based on 25% of the maximum day demand. The fire suppression storage is the maximum required fire by zone, meaning by area within the distribution system or pressure zone in the distribution system. And then emergency storage is identified as 150% of the average day demand. So again, that's the storage criteria that we use. And so these are a little bit hard to see on the screen, but you should have them in your packet. But we identified several deficiencies in the distribution system as it relates to storage. There's a couple here. The Nutmeg Zone, the Blanca Zone, and the Ridgeway Zone are areas where we identified where in either the current or future conditions, we have less storage than what we would optimally want to be able to operate the system and provide fire storage as well as emergency storage based on the criteria that we identified. So we looked at a couple of different options for overcoming some of those storage deficiencies. There were a couple different projects that came out of this. One was the replacement of the Elena tanks with a larger tank, 150,000 gallon tank, and then the Nutmeg tank, which most folks should probably heard of. That's a tank that has some existing condition issues, and we were able to kind of confirm the size of the new tank that was going to be needed there. When that tank is replaced, it needs to be upsized fairly significantly. It's about 140,000 gallons now. I think that was a question that was asked, and based on current future conditions, it would need to go to about 1 million gallons. So with that Elena storage tank, this is an example of where we worked very closely with not only Rob, but with Joe and his O&M staff to identify different options for overcoming some of these deficiencies that we identified. So we had a couple options for replacement of the Elena tank based on some input that we got from Joe and his staff. One was to replace the Elena tank, and the other was to kind of modify the city's distribution system to combine some zones and use some different storage that was available. So some zones have more storage than they need, some zones have less. So you either add storage to the ones that don't have enough, or maybe you reconfigure the system and move water around so that you don't have to add as much storage. So we looked into that, and really we did a cost analysis of these different options. This first option here, option A, is to replace the Elena tanks, and it was the lower cost alternative. So it's about $1 million to do that project. The second option was to combine zones and maybe not add a new Elena tank, but to add storage in a different zone. Because of some fire flow improvements that were required, the cost to do that was about twice what the cost of the first option was. So while it was a good idea and something that we wanted to investigate, based on the cost analysis, the decision was to move forward with option A, which is essentially what you'll see in your package there in the water CIP. We also identified some pumping analysis. This is a good example of how our analysis, again, working with O&M staff, they have operational challenges with the distribution system, the collection system, and so our analysis showed that we had some deficiencies in several different pump stations that the city currently operates, the Elena pump station and the Vashon pump station. So working with staff, and they had some ideas about maybe getting rid of this Vashon pump station. Essentially where it's located in someone's, right off of someone's front yard. It's a very small station. It's not in great condition. It's difficult to maintain. We were actually able to reconfigure the distribution system and get rid of that pump station, eliminating a headache for O&M staff. So again, another way that we worked closely with staff to develop kind of the right solution, both from a cost perspective as well as an operational perspective. Fire flow deficiencies were noted kind of throughout the city. There's not a ton of fire flow deficiencies, but we did identify some issues there. And one of the questions that was asked is why would we see fire flow deficiencies now? That could be due to different fire flow criteria that have been identified, zoning changes, For example, there was a couple of issues with, you know, school was in one zone, which would bump up the fire flow requirements, those kinds of things. So that's what's kind of triggering some of these different fire flow improvements. So again, those are kind of interspersed throughout the city, and all of these individual projects are noted in the detail that was provided in your agenda package. So the final capital improvement program on the water side, it's a total cost of about $26 million over the next 20-some-odd years. And the detail there is shown. As Rob mentioned, we put a lot of time and effort into looking at the first 5 years and trying to prioritize as best we can what we do in those first 5 years in order to come up with the most accurate estimate of what it's going to cost the city over 5 years. And then it gets a little bit grayer after in the 10, 15, and 20-year time period. It's another reason why we recommend the city kind of revisit this master planning effort every 5 years, kind of to reset and to say, okay, what projects have we done over the last 5 years? Let's relook at the model. How has that impacted the way that the system operates? Can we eliminate any projects that we thought we were going to have to do? Those kinds of things. So that's the water CIP, and then we move on to the collection systems, side of the house.
Maybe we want to take a pause here in case there's any questions on the water, side.
And with that, we'll start off with questions. Marlis, you want to start off with questions?
Well, I think I'm the one who sent in a lot of questions, so I'm getting a lot of questions answered in the presentation, and I'm not really sure which ones I think you talked a bit about what are the factors that determine the size of the pipe, and I think Ms. Winholtz asked a question about why not just replace them with a certain size pipe, and maybe you could explain that to us, why you're, I mean, as long as you're replacing pipes, why wouldn't you just make them all bigger?
No, that's a good point. So we definitely, we look at the demands within the system. So I should have maybe clarified this at the beginning, but we're using the city's updated general plan information in order to identify. We look at the zoning in different undeveloped areas, and we assign water demand factors for those different areas. And so I want to say we're right-sizing the infrastructure, so we try not to oversize things. We're trying to minimize the cost of these improvements. So if a pipe is 6 or 8 inches and a 10-inch pipe will serve the need over the course of the planning horizon, or in this case really build out of the city, we're going to recommend a 10-inch pipe and not a 12-inch pipe. So just wanted to clarify that.
Okay.
So yeah, we are actively looking at every pipe and only making it as big as it needs to be to fit within the planning criteria and meet the needs of the city.
So am I correct that at this stage you are not looking at the condition of the pipes? You don't know if some of these pipes need to be replaced sooner rather than later because they're cracked, or is this mostly just a capacity issue?
Our project did not include a specific condition assessment, which the term condition assessment brings with it a number of different connotations in terms of the level of effort that goes into assessing the condition, assigning scores for things for different pipes within the collection system. We did, the city staff has done a lot of work on condition assessment and looking at the condition of facilities. And while we didn't do a condition assessment, we relied heavily on their input when looking at different projects. For example, some of the tank projects, you know, in prioritizing different things. The Nutmeg tank, for example, is in pretty bad shape. Do we need more storage there? Yes. And so that's a project that shifted up sooner or closer in the CIP because of that condition consideration.
So if I'm understanding correctly, you did use the information from the condition of the pipes that the city knows to set priorities, so that if we are to look at what you're planning initially, these are the ones that are most in need of being replaced. And if I were to ask you for priorities among the ones you proposed in the next 5 years, could you come up with a smaller list?
We could go through that exercise.
We could do that. Probably not Not here live. Yes, we can prioritize those lists based on it. And I have to add this, it will be an iterative process as we move through the rate analysis, because we have to also right-size our rates. There may be some things that could be pushed out to an outer year. Maybe it's programmed for year five, but it could be constructed in year six or seven to more level those capital improvements projects. I just want to add, not only in the collection system do we assess the condition of the pipes, but in the water system we also have a leak detection program to assess whether we have leaks in the city. It may sound weird on how we do that, but we listen for the, or hire a company that has specific equipment that listens for those leaks. They'll do that listening in the wee hours of the night when there's not much demand, and if they are hearing flow, they narrow it down and can give us a block where it might occur. You can't, on water lines, we can't put a television camera easily in the pipe without shutting off water to a lot of people.
Well, I think
we're listening listening for leaks. We also, water leaks reveal themselves also. The water comes out of the ground. So we get a lot of calls from community members to report water coming out of the ground now. This time of year it's not so prevalent, but right after the rainy season there's a little bit of spring action, so we get water coming out of the ground naturally. But we check out each and every one of those complaints and to ensure that it's not a water main issue.
And I know I asked some questions about how much money was in the 2015 rate study related to capital improvement projects on both the water and sewer side, and how much of that might have already been spent or is available to apply to this new assessment.
So in the rate study in 2015, we anticipated on the water side about $9 million in 10 years and $6 million in the first 5 years of the rates. Sewer side, we anticipated about $10 million in through 2025 with $7.6 million in the first 5 years. To be honest with you, we spent very little of that money. I think Jen has information on how much we may have spent on capital over the last 3 years. Because of the way our budget process has been in the past, we haven't always captured those dollar amounts. We've budgeted capital in a variety of ways over the years. Sometimes it gets embedded into the operating amount because that's the way we wanted to do it at that point in time, and it's nearly it's not the best way to budget for capital. Each capital project should have a capital project number and should be traceable back to the council appropriation of those funds and to show that it's been completed and how much that project costs. That's what we are moving towards with this CIP and our new leadership in finance and city management.
Right, but you in the current or the rate study that will be coming up next, you will be incorporating.
We will be incorporating as the kind of the first cut on the rate study. We'll be incorporating the numbers that are in this analysis, and the model will be run, and we'll have a number that spits out at us, and we will or we won't like that number, and we can make adjustments to the CIP. There are some things that are more critical than others, and depending on the results, we will have to make those adjustments. I'm not because we necessarily want to, but because we have to make the entire utility and the rates as affordable as possible while still getting the job done.
That's what I wanted to hear, that we're going to go through an iterative process in doing that, and I'm sure that the council is going to be involved in that process.
Yes, I don't think we'll iterate live, but maybe we can do that.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. Any other questions, John? And then Matt and Red? Okay. Red, Matt, no, good at this time? Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good. Well, I'll move quickly through the collection system piece. And actually, when we talk about condition, I think probably the collection system is a little bit more conducive to utilizing some of the condition assessment information that's available, because as Rob mentioned, you can do CCTV, smoke testing, and other things to get an idea of where you might have some issues in the collection system. Really, with water infrastructure, you're looking at conditions of pump stations and tanks, things that are above ground a little bit more.
Eric, I'm sorry.
Sure.
Can I just interrupt you for a minute before you go into collections?
Sure.
Just one question for Rob, just as I wrote down my notes. As far as the accounting goes, with some of the new software programs that we are going towards, CityWorks and other things, how does that plan to managing and accounting projects, schedules, costs, completions? How does that fit into this? I think that's
so
the other part of the question.
CityWorks had the module that Public Works is mostly concerned about is the asset management portion of the software. It does have the ability. We haven't started using it yet. We're in the testing phase of it. It has the ability to track project costs, man hours, materials used, and those reports can be used to inform future budget years on the costs of operating and maintaining our water and wastewater infrastructure.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Thanks, Eric.
Okay. Thanks. So the process is fairly similar on the collection system side. If the person, my modeling expert here was he would probably be pretty upset that I would say that. But it's a similar exercise in terms of gathering information, building the model. We go through a calibration effort to, again, make sure that the model is functioning properly. And then we run it through its paces like we do with the water distribution model, and we figure out what the deficiencies are based on a set of planning criteria that we use, figure out the deficiencies, come up with cost estimates, and then program those into the CIP. So again, here's the calibrated sewer model. The blue lines there represent the underground infrastructure in the city, and then the green dots represent the wastewater generation or the wastewater flows at each individual location. In terms of planning criteria, really for the collection system, we look at both kind of average conditions, but really for the collection system, we're really concerned with peak wet weather conditions. We're concerned with the most amount of flow that the collection system is going to see, because again, the point of the collection system is to capture that flow, convey it to the wastewater treatment plant. We don't want to have sanitary sewer overflows, and this goes back to some of the questions that were asked about what are the criteria that we use on the collection system side. Does it have to do with overflows? That's what we're trying to avoid. So first wanted to say we look at a design storm, and we work with staff to figure out what the most appropriate design storm is. Again, this is a little bit of the art in the modeling, where you want to pick a design storm that's representative, but you don't want to pick a design storm that's overly conservative, that shows that every pipe in the system is deficient, and the city's going after and doing a lot of improvements that may not be necessary. In the case of Morro Bay, we used a 10-year, 24-hour event as the design storm. So we overlay that on top of the model and the base wastewater flows in the city, and that's how we come up with our peak wet weather flows. So that's kind of the number one piece of planning criteria that we first use. And then, like the water distribution system, we also look at the flow in the pipes, and we use criteria to figure out if something is deficient based on the flow in the pipes. For the existing sewers, we look and we said, okay, during these peak wet weather conditions, we don't want sewage coming out onto the street, but we want to be a little bit less conservative than making sure that all of the sewage stays within the pipes. So the criteria that we use to determine if something is deficient is if an existing pipe, if the flow during this peak wet weather event is 5 feet below the manhole rim, so essentially 5 feet below the top of the manhole. As long as the flow is that in that location, then the pipe is not deemed as deficient. We, again, as the water, like we did on the water side of the house, We're a little bit less restrictive on new pipes, and so we want to design new pipes so that we keep all the flow within the pipe. Again, the lift stations are kind of analogous to the water pump, the booster pump stations on the water side. Again, we're looking at firm capacity, meaning we want to make sure we have enough capacity with some redundancy, because if a pump fails, again, we want to make sure that we're being able to move that sewage out of the lift station, again, avoiding those sanitary sewer overflows. So firm capacity, again, is the pump station's capacity with the largest pump out of service. That's what we use to look and see if there's deficiencies at the pump station or lift station sites. So we identified some deficiencies in lift station 1, both in the current and future conditions during this peak wet weather time period. So that was something that we identified. Didn't identify any issues with lift station 2 and 3. I know there was a question that was asked by Ms. Winholtz as to lift station 1 deficiencies and why it was shown the way it was shown in the CIP and phased the way it was phased in the CIP, and we can get into that when we get into the kind of the end of this. And then the majority of the collection system deficiencies were identified around Main Street. So I know Main Street is the Main Street line is something that comes up a lot in terms of the condition of the Main Street line. The city's done CCTV of that line. We knows that there's some condition issues. The nice thing about our analysis is that it actually supports replacement or doing significant rehabilitation of that line because of capacity issues. So not only are there condition issues, but during the peak wet weather events, this pipeline is deemed deficient. So a bulk of the CIP as it relates to the gravity sewers in the city are really focused on Main Street. You can see there's a couple of other little places in the city where there's some deficiencies, but for the most part, the gravity issues are with the Main Street line. We also added in a couple of different miscellaneous elements within the wastewater CIP that I wanted to mention really quickly here. We know that there's some issues with the collection system west of the highway, contributes to higher INI. That was something that we saw in the flow study that was done by the city, kind of leading up to us starting our evaluation. And so we've got some dollars in there yearly for the city to replace pipes in that area. We also have periodic master plan updates. It's something that we put in there is every 5 years. The city opens back up the master plan, reruns the model, puts in the new information, and updates the master plan. We have some general pipeline replacements. Again, that's aimed at fixing pipes that are deficient, so a continuous, you know, pot of money that the city has available every single year that they can periodically replace the pipes that are in the worst condition. So that's something that we include. Periodic flow monitoring is also something that's a good thing to do, like the 5-year CIP or 5-year master plan updates. Again, projects are going to be done aimed at reduction of INI, and so by redoing flow monitoring studies periodically, it's a way to look at what are those improvements buying the city in terms of INI reduction. And then we also had a cost in there for manhole replacements citywide. That was another one of the miscellaneous line items that we included. So this is the final collection system CIP. It's about $18.2 million, for the 20-year planning horizon, and that's broken down into a couple different categories. You can see that first line there where it says gravity mains. It's about $5 million. It's a lot of that is the bulk of that is associated with the Main Street line replacement. There's some money in there for lift stations as well as some money in there for the force main from lift station number 1. And then, as I mentioned, as you go down further on the list, there's some miscellaneous rehabilitation projects for existing pipelines with condition issues. In terms of next steps, so that's kind of the overview of the water and sewer CIP, but in terms of next steps, as I mentioned, one of the elements of the One Water Plan is the stormwater system. It's probably the most challenging aspect of the One Water Plan because of the information that's available on the city stormwater system. It's taken us a long time to recreate that system in the model. And so we're working on identifying all the deficiencies in that system and coming up with the CIP. We should have that done within the month of June. As we mentioned, an important piece of the One Water Plan, it really dovetails with the WRF program is a water supply evaluation. So we've come to a place where we've completed the water supply evaluation, and we want to bring that to PWAB and Council here in the next in the coming months. We are going to be finalizing our report chapters in the months of June and July with the goal of bringing the final One Water Plan to PWAB in August and then bringing it to Council in the following month in September. So that's kind of a timeline of the rest of our efforts as it relates to One Water. With that, any questions?
Okay, questions. I'll look to my left. Red, do you want to start off with questions? Matt?
Rob, I guess I have a question. I do believe for you before going to Eric. In terms of looking at the schedule for this One Water Plan to be done and understanding the various actions that we are doing together, looking at the wharf and whatnot, how would we use this One Water Plan? We're going to have this, we get this plan back, and then each year we will look at what's recommended and then decide what can be financially done for that year?
Yes. Each year the projects will make their way into the budget, and it'll be, you know, Council's decision whether to allocate and appropriate the funds to perform those improvements based on revenues that are available for that work. Advice from our interim city manager at one of his former cities was that, you know, things that you need to look at is, you know, the performance of your rate model in association with your expenses, and do that every couple of years. Look at that. Do you need to the rate model will set up a schedule of water sewer rate increases over time. Do you actually need to impose to the maximum amount required to get the revenue in to perform to make the utility work? And rather than think of it as a routine increase, to take a hard look at that and make sure that your rates are appropriately sized for your expenses, or your expenses are appropriately sized to your rates.
Okay, and with that in mind, and Eric, I guess this is for you, looking at the cost analysis that you've put in these various plans, doing those, that work, is that a, how, I guess, rough of an estimate of the plan is that? Because I'm thinking of all of the wear and tear and tearing up of streets and roads to put this new pipe in to do this One Water Plan. Is the streets and roads included in those cost analyses?
I believe for the individual pipeline work, I think it's a cut and patch essentially. It does not include kind of repaving the whole road wherever we're doing
the reason I think of that, because Rob, I guess this question is back to you, knowing that the Nutmeg Tank, we've been talking about it for a number of years since I was on PWAB, and then knowing that we've had a number of we've done a lot of work, and I don't mean to get in the weeds here, but knowing if we were going to put a Nutmeg Tank up there, are we going to tear up those roads up there, knowing that we've done a lot of that pipe work in the last few years?
So the Nutmeg Tank doesn't involve a lot of piping in the street. There's an easement called the Laurel Easement, which conveys the pipe. There's water, stormwater, and sewer in that Laurel Easement. Comes almost directly straight down the hill from the Nutmeg Tank. So most of that piping work would occur in the Laurel Easement. One of the concerns with the Nutmeg Tank and the streets is there will be a lot of heavy equipment that needs to make its way up to that tank site through roads that were marginally constructed as roads. So we'll have to assess their condition. There is also a coordination effort between the our pavement management program and the installation and repair of utilities. You don't want to be repairing a street 1 year and cutting it back open the next year to put in a water. That's a public works director's nightmare to explain why you just did that. And I've seen that happen before. When utilities and streets are not under the same department is when it can happen most often. So it's a coordination effort. We need to look at our pavement maintenance program. We need to look at our sewer water CIP list, merge the two together, and make sure that we're not, you know, doing something in the near term that's going to affect the other repair work.
Okay, and I guess that's the wonderful answer I was looking for, that keyword coordination, looking at the one plan, looking at the questions that Marlis was asking. Coordination is a huge part of this, so thank you. That's all my questions.
I guess I have an advantage. I just need to coordinate with myself is here in Morro Bay.
John?
Thanks. When you learn that skill, let me know because I want to do it too. Hey, thanks, Eric, for the presentation, and thanks, Rob, thank for you. The commentary. Just a couple few questions. In terms of prioritizing, I'm just in my mind thinking, you know, I just wrote down kind of three ways to prioritize these projects. And when I say these, all of them, mm-hmm. thinking of them the same way. One would be like a group that are critical, must do, or the system's going to fail. I'm just thinking that way. A second might be it would be nice to do it, but maybe not necessarily or not needed right now. We could continue without a problem. And the third would be maybe, gosh, if this were a state-of-the-art system, this would be ideal. And, gosh, we really don't need to do it. But, you know, if we really want to have the ideal system, let's do it. And so that's just a rough way of doing it. Mm-hmm. How have you gone about and how will we go about determining and understanding the absolute need to replace a piece of this that's critical infrastructure that has to be replaced, or that's just a nicety, or that makes us look shiny and new?
Yeah. I think that's a good question. And I'll start by saying that Morro Bay is a little bit different than the Morro Bay situation, a little bit different than some of the infrastructure planning work that I've done other places, in that there isn't a lot of growth. So we're not talking about increasing the capacity of the collection system by a large amount over the next 20 years, which essentially takes you to your build-out condition. So, you know, deficiencies that exist now in the model, you know, they're not, a lot of them are not being created by future conditions, they're existing conditions, and the city's living with those quote-unquote existing deficiencies now. So I think that gives you a lot of leeway to make those decisions to say, okay, this is something that's showing as deficient in the model, but it's something that we've been able to get along with. What I would suggest in terms of making prioritizations would be kind of improvements that have multiple benefits. So a good one, you know, the Main Street line, not only is there a known condition issue, but there's also a capacity deficiency. So you've got kind of two reasons why you would want to replace that line. It's not that it's a brand new line and it's capacity deficient, so you don't want to go and replace it because it's in good condition. You've got two different drivers there for that. The other one is some of the improvements associated with the Vashon pump station. There's an operational issue that's there. There's a capacity issue that's there. So another way that you might want to prioritize that project is, you know, if we do that project, not only do we get rid of a capacity issue, but we also get rid of this operational headache that O&M staff has to deal with now. So that's kind of some of the ways that I would look at it. And then, again, the other thing would be streets projects. There's a streets project that's already planned to move forward, and there's a pipeline replacement that needs to happen because of a fire flow deficiency. Again, it's probably not a large line. It might not be a large section of line. That might be another reason to, you know, take something that may not be absolutely critical, but there's a mutual benefit there that you might want to move that forward.
That's helpful. Is that more or less how you went about kind of taking all of these, assuming they were all going to be done, and then staging them some early on versus later? Basically criteria like that, mm-hmm. that yeah. you utilize to do that, or
that's generally how we looked at it. You know, I think a good example is the Nutmeg tank. Again, another situation where there's a known capacity deficiency. I mean, it's essentially a 140,000 gallon tank. Under future conditions, again, not much growth from now until this future condition, but we need a 1 million gallon tank based on the planning criteria. So there's an obvious condition issue, and there's a capacity need. So, again, one of the reasons why that project is moved up in the CIP time period.
Mr. Heading.
Sure.
I just want to point out one more thing about when we talk about future conditions. If it does have future development related it with it, we do have an allocation of cost to what that future development should pay for those improvements based on serving that future development. So we've broken that out, and that can feed into when we update our impact fees requirements.
Yeah, each of
perfect. That's good to know. Yeah,
for each of those CIP items, there's a detail that shows, and you know, it's got an inset picture of where the pipeline is. It describes it, and in there, it'll show an allocation between existing and future users. Yeah. It'll say, you know, 100% existing, or it'll say 80-20 or something like that in there. So that's all. That's all. That all that information should be in there.
Okay, and then, did you utilize ratepayer ability to pay within the context of a period of time, and what the impact on rates may well be? For instance, if you clumped, I don't know, I'm just making this up, if you clumped $10 million worth of projects into a three-year period, the rate impact on ratepayers, which would be the majority of funds coming from that, I assume, would be huge. And so was that a consideration? I didn't hear you mention that as a criteria, and shouldn't it be?
We try to smooth things out as much as we can. Where you can kind of run into issues there is when you have a large improvement that's going to happen over a couple of years. So, you know, take for example the Main Street line replacement. I think it's about a $5 million project as it's estimated in the CIP. You know, that's going to happen over the course of a couple of years, and so that might be a larger rate impact over those couple of years, but we have done our best to kind of smooth things out as much as possible. And then if I can kind of punt that question a little bit, it's something that we will be looking at more as we're going through the rate study, because this is just one piece of the larger, you know, the O&M side of the house and everything else on water and sewer.
Yeah, and I would assume you would want to do that because I'll get to my last question about rates at the end, but I just wanted to throw that in. The second question was, are there regulatory requirements that drive any of the stuff that we're projected to do within this plan here? And are we not complying with certain regulations that are mandating that we do this?
I'll take that one on. For example, the Main Street line. We've been put on notice by the Water Quality Control Board for not because of exfiltration or sewage leaking out, but because of water leaking into that system. They want to minimize that inflow and intrusion into the system so that you potentially will not overwhelm a wastewater treatment plant. Another code requirement is when Eric was talking about fire flow requirements. We've adopted International Fire Code, the State Fire Code, which have those numbers come right out of the fire code, and those are to maintain our rating as a community rating and our discounted costs for our fire insurance. We need to be able to provide that level of fire protection.
So in some cases, there are regs that would mandate some work would have to be done, but maybe not the majority of this is being driven by any kind of regulations that we're not meeting that could mean that we're out of compliance, fined, or there could be major consequences associated with that. I'm just trying to understand how that all fits.
Other than some of it is regulated by, I would have to say, the laws of physics.
I get that.
Get and that much water through a pipe. So physically, the system cannot provide for that capacity. So, you know, that's one of the criterias. And then I would say that the regulatory component is probably a smaller component, the statute level of laws that we want to avoid breaking. Of course, we can't break the laws of physics.
Right, and I think we all know when old parts wear out, you replace them.
Yeah.
But then, you know, it's nice to anticipate that they're going to wear out and need to be replaced before they break. And you do that because it's more cost effective to do that earlier than waiting 10 years longer and paying a higher price for it. So I'm trying to figure out how you guys think in terms of and all this works, not being an engineer. My third question is this. From a funding perspective, my sense would be, in terms of setting rates, because this is part of an enterprise that will fund capital improvements, and we're going to try to understand from our existing 218 vote that occurred in 2015 that we've got a certain amount of dollars available for capital improvement projects. Those dollar amounts will be determined and how they can be applied given the existing rate structure to maybe the first phasing of projects that you're looking at, whatever time horizon that might be. And then my assumption would be somewhere down the line, maybe 5 or 10 years, the city might have to look again at the next phase and determine if another rate increase were necessary because the next set of CIPs were going to be needed to be completed. Is that a correct way to think about how this thing is going to work?
That's a good question, and we'll be working through those details with the rate consultant. But ideally, this whole 20-year CIP is what will go into the rate model. The rate model will include 20, 30-year horizons in terms of the payback of any kind of loans that you would need for construction of the wharf. So it's going to look at this long-term planning horizon and could set rates for that 20-year or 30-year period. To support 20 or 30-year period.
Go ahead. Yeah.
I would say that the kind of the 5-year check-in is really to look and see, okay, do we have the right mix of projects in the next 5 years? Maybe not necessarily with the city system. Are we going to put in a bunch of new projects? But it might be, can we eliminate any projects? Or based on anything that we're seeing, do we need to pull up any projects? So this one area of the city didn't look like it was an issue before, but recently, over the last couple of years, we've gotten a lot of issues with main breaks and those kinds of things. So that maybe that project has to get moved up, and that makes another project move out or something like that.
Yeah.
So it's really, in terms of the master planning cycle, it's really a pause and kind of reassess the projects as they exist in this master plan. They really shouldn't change too much, at the next master plan update and the next master plan update, barring any changes within the system in terms of condition. It's really going to be the mix. And, are the 15 to 20-year projects now look like they should be the 5 to 10-year projects, or how do those move around? So,
I also want to add that these are planning-level cost estimates. So when we go through design and actually bid these projects to be constructed, we'll have the real cost, and that will influence the comparison of costs to rates too. So we're carrying the appropriate level of contingency with the level of information that we have, the design information that we have now, which is very planning level design information. So as that's one of the reasons you want to look at your expenditures versus your rates on a fairly regular basis to make sure that you're right-sizing those two components.
Good. I assume that you put an accelerator in there for the projects that are 20 years out. They're not in today's dollars. Those are going to be in dollars that are 20 years from now, I assume.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I saw that, and I just wanted to hear you say it because it's important to hear you say it. And what happens if we do nothing? We don't adopt the plan, and we don't do anything.
It'll be reactive maintenance. Mm-hmm. So okay. As things break, and they will, we'll repair them. We'll get a call in the middle of the night with a water main break, and we'll send out our crews and scramble to get a contractor mobilized. We won't have an opportunity to bid that. We'll call who's ever available, and we'll pay for that. And it's always more of a mess when there's you're hip deep in water and trying to repair a water line than fixing it as a planned replacement or repair.
I wasn't suggesting that we do nothing.
Sure.
I was just asking the question.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so I get that scenario. My very last question is this. I promise you, this, and this is it. It's my understanding that this gets refined again and again and again before final decisions are made. In other words, the public out there may think or assume that we're looking at, you know, $40 million worth of improvements, and rates are going to be assessed based upon that, and that once we look at this, this is approved. And the question is, we're not approving anything tonight, are we? We're just looking at a plan that identifies system deficiencies and that needs to be looked at by council and determine what the costs are in the future, and then make decisions based upon that information that we receive.
Yeah.
That's correct.
That's correct.
Even when you do approve this plan sometime later on this summer, you will not be approving the projects until we bring them forward with each budget year. So they'll be assessed at that time to make sure that we have sufficient revenues to construct those, and we'll be reporting back every budget year on what we did build.
Sometimes that message is not real clear to the public that's watching. I just wanted to make sure they knew no action has been taken, and we're not deciding on anything tonight.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think the only thing that's really these are the projects. So based on our view of the need of the system, these are the projects. Now, whether they're built next year, 5 years from now, 20 years from now, or they don't make it into the CIP, those are the things that council will be able to influence, I think.
Good.
And I'd like to add something real quick. The 2015 or 14 rate increases that became in effect in 2015 used a very, I say not substandard, but a far more preliminary view of capital needs. So the One Water planning process takes it to that next level to really assess kind of for the future what we need to do and the steps we need to take. The Blue Ribbon Commission, hasn't been stated here, is looking at all like three major components of the system: the operation and maintenance, you know, which is basically our employees and the work that they do every day to keep the system up and running, and then the capital, which is being provided with One Water, the planning update, as well as the wharf project. And the Blue Ribbon Commission is really tasked with looking at that independently. Of course, they're asking us questions, but they're going to work directly with the rate consultant and try to come up with a package that's affordable, right? I mean, everybody has a different view of what we can and cannot do, but ultimately it's the ratepayers are going to decide. So they're really looking at it from that lens, like what's equitable and what's going to be the most affordable given the needs. So that's something we want to make sure is instituted in this discussion. Then it'll go to WharfCAC, then it'll go to City Council. So there'll be ample opportunity for refinement on how those three pieces work together and ultimately help set the rate.
It's interesting how perception and reality are often two different things. And so the reason I went through that litany of questions was to make sure that our public understands exactly what we're doing, why we're doing it, and what we're doing tonight. So thanks for that. I appreciate that.
Before I go into questions, I just want to make one more comment on our city manager, the comment about the 2015 rate based on, I think you said, a kind of a substandard review of what the necessities were for CIP. And to be clear, that was largely driven by the fact that we weren't meeting our state water requirement, and that's what initially drove that to begin with, and that's what initiated the rate study. And at the time, there was the wastewater plant that was coming on, all that, and there's a lot that dovetailed together. And even the wastewater rate study that we went in there, that was clear. Hey, this isn't to say that we're not going to be coming back. I know that seems to be conflicted for some in the community, but largely that was driven at a time when we received a letter from the state water, our state water supplier, saying we weren't meeting our contractual obligation, which we had to do by law. So that's what initiated that. Matt? Marlo's a question? Sorry. Yeah, thanks. Thank you. Sorry, I was going the wrong way.
Well, I do have more questions, but
I'm sorry. We were still going this way for questions.
No,
is that right? Okay,
no,
I'm sorry.
No,
it's Marlo's. Okay, sorry.
I've been waiting.
All right, thank you.
Fortunately, I had many of the same questions that John just asked. I really did want to understand how you prioritize projects, because that's really critical. And knowing that we're going into the rate assessment process and we're going to determine what our citizens can afford, I think it's really important that if we come back and say, you know what, we're going to have to cut this by 60%, what are the top projects that we can actually build into this current rate structure? And hopefully you can tell us that, and I think that's really important to understand. I wanted to just make sure two things, because I think we've covered almost everything. First of all, when we talk about the lift stations in here, is any of that, is that over and above what we're talking about in the lift stations in the WRF project, or is this, is there some duplication here of effort between this and the WRF lift?
No, so that maybe that's a quick clarification that, again, I should have made at the beginning. When we're talking about, so first of all, when we're talking about the collection system and evaluation of the collection system and the flows that we're applying, those are Morro Bay only flows. They do not include Cayuga. So that, I just wanted to make that clear.
Right.
And we, I talked about that back in January, but again, it's just the Morro Bay flows. Again, consistent with the work that's going on the WRF side of things as well. And then in terms of the lift stations, this evaluation only looked at the city's three existing lift stations. So any of the costs that we're talking about here, any of the projects are outside of the lift station that would be necessary to take flow from the existing treatment plant and send it to South Bay Boulevard. So those are, they're different things.
So we are not...
There's no duplication.
We're still going to be using these lift stations in addition to. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. Maybe yes and no. The designer that's looking at the new lift station is looking at different concepts that may that may take flow from different parts of the city, and so it may utilize the lift stations in a little bit of a different way. But for the large extent of it, no, there's not a lot of duplication there.
Okay, and I noted that there was a $1.4 million upgrade to the desal plant, and I'm just curious, at this point, do you know how the desal plant is going to fit into our overall water supply, or is this something that's necessary regardless of how extensively we use it?
Those were line items that we included in the CIP based on some input from staff in terms of the existing brackish water RO facility. It gets used pretty regularly, but it's a pretty manual operation. There's not a lot of automation. There's some issues with the condition of the existing building. And so what we did is we put some CIP numbers in there to mitigate some of those issues. As we work through the rate study and we figure out what exactly is happening with the WRF program, those are projects that very well could get pushed out very far on the CIP or could fall off of the CIP depending on what the long-term role that the brackish water desal facility plays in the city's water future. So, again, those are things that may not make the final cut, I guess, and may not be necessary. But we thought it was prudent to include those based on the existing condition, based on the way that the city operates that facility. If it were to continue to operate like it operates, it would need some R&R and some improvements there.
And in the rate that we're going to be looking at this summer, the possible rate increase, that is a rate increase that would be in effect for 5 years, correct?
Five years?
Isn't it just a five-year rate increase that we're talking about?
Depending upon the way the five-year increases are levied, then yes, it'd be 5 years. But if it's a established fee, it could be a 10-year project or fee structure approval.
We could project rates out over 10 years, you're saying?
If you give specific defined rate amounts for that 10-year period, yes. The risk is the guess is wrong, which is why it's...
And I just want to make sure that just for my understanding and for everybody who might be listening, that If we enact, I know the last one was for a five-year rate increase, and if we did nothing, then those rates would just remain the way they were.
The fifth year's rate would just continue.
Correct. Right. And presumably in those 5 years, we're including some amount of money for capital improvements, right, for that period. So that would also then be included in the next period if you just kept the same rates. If you just did. Is that correct? I'm just wanting to understand.
Yes, there is a portion that was assigned to CIPs that would continue to go to that. There are some communities that will set a maximum rate of whatever it is, and every year council decides what they will collect versus what the maximum rate will be.
But we have not done that.
We have not done that here.
Right. Okay, and this is my last question. and it's, I think, similar to what John asked. What are the risks associated with not doing all of these things?
Things will break.
Okay. I knew you were going to say that.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, thanks. Just a few more questions here.
Yeah.
thanks for... I know you are working busy on some of the questions, Rob, and I'm just looking at what I sent and what was going over. So on the staff report, it says in 1997 we did a water master plan, and then in 2005 we did a sewer collection system master plan, and then in 87 we did a storm drain master plan. So my question, and I'm just going to focus on the water and the sewer collections. So in 1997, as we're doing now with this, did we assign, you know, a CIP program based on that water master plan and the sewer collections master plan in 2005?
I could not determine in 97, looking at the 97 budget, how they assign there were some capital projects in there, but the way we used to do things is embed capital like projects, smaller capital projects, in the actual operating budget. So it's, I can't tell.
Okay, that's fine. So then, do we know, were there any Prop 218s initiated from any of these plans?
Yes, there was a Prop 218 in for the sewer project. I think it was 2008 did a Prop 218 that incorporated capital improvements with it. We, in fact, have done much of the major capital improvements. We reconstructed three lift stations or two lift stations and did some upgrades to lift station one as part of the project. We have a I&I reduction program where we broke the city up into segments and have been televising it and doing point repairs every year. The line that we have been kind of avoiding because of its proximity to where we might have put the WRF project is the Main Street line. So I think we're free to, well, once we get done with this summer, we may be free to work on that project.
So looking at the 1997 Water Master Plan and then the 2005 Sewer Collection System Master Plan and creating a CIP, and I think I wrote in my notes here that the projects are approved in the annual budget. So when we're doing this one water plan and developing a CIP for this, and then we're also exploring, do we initiate another rate increase or Prop 218 or rates study, how are we going to manage that? Okay, we've adopted this and we know that we're going to implement this over 20 years if we're approving it year by year. And I guess I want to understand that, are we looking at you know, a five-year CIP on this based on this plan, and councils will have a picture of that. How's a council going to know that we're ongoing implementing something that we've adopted in this plan? Because this transcends it through a 20-year period, and we're talking, you know, through a couple of plans that were done that preceded all of us, and just want to understand how we can identify and track that. And then again, you know, our community wants to know as well, because we might be assessing, you know, new rates to continue on to fix something, you know, for the next 20 years.
So the budget and the CIP are inseparable processes. You can't have really one without a complete one without the other. We, in past CIPs, you go to the schedules in the back and you'll see a list of projects. In past years, there was no real tie between an appropriation for those projects and the project listing. Some might look at that CIP list in the back of the budget and assume that everything was approved to be constructed because it's in the budget, but there is no tie. We need to create that tie through each budget year and say these projects are budgeted for this year. As I pointed out earlier, these are preliminary planning level numbers. As we move, for example, we will I'll use the Nutmeg Tank for an example. We will estimate the amount of engineering work that it's going to take. We'll put that in the budget. Construction work. We'll get that approved by council, and we'll move forward. When we get to the next budget year, we will know, you know, it costs that amount, it costs less than that amount. We'll have amounts in our accumulation to budget for the next budget year. I don't know if I'm answering your question.
No, I think it's it, thanks. I think there's relevance to the conversation, because going through 6 years of budget so far, we look at our CIPs, and quite frankly, we look at the enterprise funds and water, wastewater, and I think from my own perspective, it's easy to say, of course, you know, here's our enterprise fund, and here's our CIP, and these are the projects that need to be done, but don't necessarily know that there's that nexus between a 1997 water master plan or a 2005 sewer plan, and are we meeting our expectations? We, you know, developed this, and are we completing everything in the 5-year period, 10-year period, 20-year period? And, you know, maybe that's into too much details for council, and that's, you know, what, you know, you're supplying us in chunks of time.
Well, I think that's the point of doing the updates, is doing those regular updates, we can report back on how we performed. With each budget year, we should also report back on that last year's CIP list even in our quarterly budget updates, just to give an update on the standing. You know, quite frankly, I think in the past, from a staff's point of view, the way it was looked at was, we have X amount in accumulation, we have less than X amount in projects we want to do, we're good, we're going to do all those, and there was no real tie to the budget,
and
to be honest.
And so you bring up a good point, but what this is also, what I interpret out of this plan, is that you're not just looking at what's in the accumulation fund and what's on the list, but you're looking at a highly developed set of priorities. And so you're going to be looking at your accumulation fund, and of course, well, this list is prioritized based on the needs, not just it's a list, you know,
and I think that list will probably change either a little bit or a lot each and every budget year.
Okay. All right, those are all my questions. Were there any other follow-up questions at this point from council? We can go to public comment. None? Okay, thank you, Eric.
Thank you.
First up on public comment, Betty Winholtz, and then next, Jeff Heller.
Could we have the heat turned on, please? Would that be okay, Eric? Thanks. It's cold back there.
My name's Betty Winholtz. I did send some questions to Mr. Livick earlier today, and a few of those have been answered. I want to pull out some that I feel were not answered. We spoke, or he spoke, in reference to the Vashon pump station, and both that one and the Elena one, which supports the Nutmeg tanks. He did not say why those two, which are at capacity or over, are not higher up on the priority, at least if you consider priority in terms of the year they're supposed to be completed, or they've scheduled to be completed. So I'd like to know why those aren't higher in priority. Did not answer the question of how much does $100,000 get us per year, and that was the figure used for both the wastewater collection side as well as the water distribution side. Is that like a block? Is that like a mile? How much are you talking about can be fixed for $100,000 in those general fix-it things that they had at the end? I did not understand, I did not hear explained how a pump replaces capacity, which is on WPWS2. I don't understand how it is that we would upgrade the pump at the Elena station for the Nutmeg tank when the Nutmeg tank's going to get bigger or replaced. Why would you do it in that order? Why would you not do the tank before the pump? Or is it far enough out that we need to fix the pump sooner? Just from the title of this program, you know, the One Water, I would assume you would be talking about our wells, both the Choro and the Moro wells, and that's not in here at all. It doesn't address whether or not we've put in the flow meter on the Choro Creek. Is that in another section of this project or this program, or should that have been included in here? On the WWRR/1 project, in the text, it talks about 8-inch pipes, but in the table, it refers to 12-inch type pipes. So I was confused about where we headed here, what size piping are we using. I think I'll just close with a couple of statements. Those were my major or important questions. One, I'm not in favor of spending $17,000 on trees. I can't believe you would spend that much on trees just to make a plant look good outside the whatever facility it was supposed to go. I can't imagine how many trees that would be if you would spend $17,000 on trees. It seems to me that the water for the water system that you want to put in for the fire out at the Wharf CAC out at South Bay, that you're saying that coming up Quintana and going down Quintana, both sides of those, should not be related to the Wharf CAC, and the cost should come from there. You admit in one of those that it is related specifically to that, but
thank
you're
you,
not saying why then the Wharf CAC's not paying for that.
Thank you, Betty. Jeff Heller.
Jeff Heller, good evening. I think the council's asking a lot of very good questions. The fundamental question that I've been asking for over a year, I believe, is an accounting of the projects that were identified in the 2015 rate increases. And by accounting, I mean if $6.5 million was identified for water infrastructure improvements, how much of that money, or how many of those projects, rather, have been completed. There was a reference by our city manager that a lot of the rate increase money has not been used for those projects. So what I've asked for quite some time now is basically a single-page, simple document that I can understand as well as anyone walking down the street in terms of where has that money gone, how much of it is left. When I ask that question, I tend to get referred to multiple links on the website, which I don't really fully understand, long, deep reports. So that question for me has really never been answered. I think you said that part of what Carollo is doing is looking back on the projects, the CIPs from the 2015 rate increases, to find out what those expenses are and roll that into this new rate increase, at least the projects that have not been done. Maybe I misunderstood that. But I would like some clarification on that. obviously, budgeting and all of this can be very complicated, but it really comes down to very simple numbers to me, which is what are our revenues, how much money do we have, and what has been spent. And as our public works director has described it, typically large agencies or even on a personal budget level, you identify projects and you put a budget in there, what you think it'll cost. You figure out where that money's going to come from. And then when that project is done, you say, well, this is what we spent on it. I am at an absolute loss that this city does not have that information. It's not rocket science. It's very basic budgeting expenses. You do it with your personal budget. I don't know why I can't get this question answered. And lastly, I don't understand how the city can have the sheer gall to go out for another rate increase when they can't tell us how we spent the money from the increase in 2015. It's a major problem for me personally, and it's a major problem for a number of residents in this city. And until that question is answered in a format that we can understand, we will continue to try and stop the project by stopping the funding. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff. Anybody else for public comment? Seeing none, I'll close public comment and bring it back to council. And into discussion. So did you want to go over some of the talking points as far as this was just basically an update on where we're at? We had good discussion on that. Were there any preliminary requests for direction on any parts of this? And then again, there were some questions on wells and why that wasn't part of the report in here too. Maybe you can get to that as well.
Well, that's part of our water supply assessment, and we did a little bit of that prioritization and what potential future water supplies are. We will return to that.
It will be part of this.
It will be part of that, the water supply assessment. That will be part of that. Let's see, trees, $17,000 in trees. That was a requirement of the coastal permit for the existing desal brackish water RO facility to plant a vegetated buffer. There's no room between the street and the plant to plant trees, so if we were going to do that, we would realign the street to create a strip. That would be one of those projects that we would have to look at to see if will that facility be there long term, and you know, when would we really need to do that project? WWRR1. I'm looking for that to determine what's going on. Maybe Eric can come up, and I'll call a friend to help me with that. I think maybe we need some additional clarification from Ms. Winholtz. Got a message from Eric that, you know, the tables look consistent, so
That one I need to get a little bit more clarification on.
But that's something you can follow up on?
Sure. Yes. Yeah, we've got these questions, okay. And yeah, we've got some preliminary answers.
So we'll follow up and make sure that we get clarification, and if it needs to be addressed in the plan, we will address it in the plan.
Yeah. Great.
Cool, thanks.
All right, any other comments or discussion from council? Marlos?
I just have a question. You were talking about when we approve this plan, and I'd like to know what that means when we approve the plan. We aren't approving the projects per se. We're just basically
saying... We adopt the plan.
We're saying that these are projects we'd like to do, but it all does depend on availability of funds, so...
Yes, it's like adopting a general plan or a planning document. It sets the course for the future, and you make course adjustments along the way because there's some statement about best laid plans that, you know, we do have to make course corrections as we go, and we'll reprioritize depending on availability of funds and needs within the system.
Said another way, and there's no commitment. The council is not committing to everything that's in the plan.
Right. Yeah,
unless they want to make that commitment.
Well, is not the comment on the subject line of our staff report review and provide comment on the one water update?
Yep.
And provide direction?
Yep. Okay. So this is going to continue. This is the most recent update.
Yes, this is an update.
Come back and we'll,
Yes, and we'll, as Mr. Caceres pointed out, we'll be bringing back to you the water supply update, and then the final draft plan will be presented to the council.
Okay. Okay, with that then, Damaris, thanks for coming out tonight. you too, Eric. Thank you. And then with that, we'll conclude item C1 and move on. Do you have comments on item C1?
Sorry. I just want to address the one of the comments from the public, and it's a fair one just about the 2015 rates. I wish we had we could have more definitive information. Our finance director can kind of explain some of the nuances and why it might be tricky to get specific. What dollar is an increase because of the rates increase? What dollar is accounted for because of different usage rates? So it's a bit complicated, but ultimately, on a general level, we haven't spent a lot of the money on capital because we haven't been able to execute capital projects, in part because we were waiting for the one water plan, and the other part is we don't have sufficient staff at this point to execute a lot of our projects. So that's kind of, those are both factors that we had to have to account for. So we do have a lot of accumulation from both the water and sewer that will help fund both the wharf project if it's approved and moves forward, as well as the capital projects identified through the one water plan. So I just want to make sure we hear that concern. It's the same concern of ours, and we're trying to work on it and make sure that any formulation of a rate would be able to explain that as precisely as possible, what the 2015 has done and what has been spent, what hasn't been spent. And I let Jen speak to that a little bit more.
Thank you, Scott. Thanks, Jen.
Yeah, so one of the challenges, I know Mr. Heller has raised this question in the past, and we've heard it from other members of the community and the council. One of the challenges that we're facing is that you know, it's not linear mathematics. So there was a rate increase, but there was also changes in consumption or usage. So if consumption has gone up and coupled with the rate increase, it's not linear to, you know, just do a flat mathematical. You want to compare the same usage, same consumption, and then, you know, multiply that by the rate increase to get what was the actual increase. You know, conversely, usage or consumption could have gone down, but the rates went up. So that's what we're really struggling with, is how to capture what the usage was, both commercially and residentially, and how that impacted the rates going forward. So that's why, you know, to give a precise number of what dollars the increase has been a little bit of a challenge, in that our accounting system doesn't recognize that and doesn't apply it for usage, because we didn't charge a separate account code for just the increase part. And I think that would be the only way we could really capture that true, what was the increase and how much did we see coming in as revenues. We can easily see what's in accumulation. So from 14-15 through what we project year-end to date, we're looking at, you know, $2.2 million in water revenue increases and about $2 million in sewer increases. Our accumulation funds have increased, you know, $3 million in sewer and about $2 million in water over the course of the increase. So that's an indication of those rate increases, but again, it's offset by, you know, operating expenditure changes and what was spent in capital. But just to explain a little bit why it's not just an easy calculation, because you have to take into account these other factors and what dollars what.
Thanks, Jen.
But I'm assuming that we could explain where the money, how the money has been spent. We know it's been spent on salaries. We know how much it costs to operate the facilities, correct? Right.
We can explain how money has been spent since 2015, but
right,
to be able to say this dollar was an increased dollar and this dollar was pre-increased dollar, it's hard to get that exactly right, but generally we can get close to that, and I think that's what we're trying to explain. That we're going to try to get as precise as possible without spending $1 million to determine how each of those dollars were spent.
Gotcha. Thank you,
John.
Just a quick comment, and it is complex, and especially if you go back to the last rate study and you look at the methodology and you look at the line items. But I think what would be helpful is if the simple quarterly report that is, I'll just say it out loud, is overdue, would be reported, even though it doesn't tie a dollar of revenue increase to whatever the expenditure is. It does give a very clear picture of what the expenditures are and have been, and you can take it back to 2015. And maybe that's a start to at least get some information. And I know we don't want to put anything out there that isn't precise, but trying to tie it to that exact dollar rate increase might not be possible without another rate study, to be honest. I don't know, Jen, maybe that is possible. But as a start, my suggestion would be that we do get that quarterly report as soon as possible.
Any other comments? None? Okay. Then that'll conclude item C1. And Rob, Eric, Damaris, Jen, everybody, thanks. Can we take just a short recess just before we get into C2? Just a short. So we'll take a short recess and we'll be right back. Thanks. All right, welcome back, everyone. Thanks for the short recess. Next up on the agenda is item C2, and this is consideration and approval of issuance of request for proposals on lease site 62W, known as Kayak Horizons, and that's located at 551 Embarcadero. And I think, Eric, you're going to introduce this to us.
Yes, I am. Thank you, Mayor Arnes, and good evening, Council. So up for consideration tonight is a RFP, Request for Proposals, on lease site 6262W, commonly known as Kayak Horizons. Got a little PowerPoint presentation here. Purpose tonight is kind of threefold. Obtain council approval for issuing this Request for Proposals, RFP, to put Kayak Horizons out to bid. Obtain council input on some of the elements of the RFP document and the process, and then obtain council input and direction on operation of the lease site after the current lease's expiration at the end of this coming September. We're recommending council approve issuance and advertising of this RFP, again, with any council-directed changes that you may so deem tonight, and authorize a month-to-month holdover of the existing lease with the existing tenant, which is Dennis Kruger, under the following parameters: about a 12 to 18-month term. Amend the holdover rent structure to be the same as the existing rent structure. The existing rent says when it goes into holdover, the rent doubles, which I don't think Dennis would be amenable to. And subject to normal CPI adjustment come July 1 if necessary, and terminable upon successful RFP proposer obtaining concept approval and getting a new grant or getting a new lease. Alternatives: don't put the RFP out and direct me accordingly. There are no immediate fiscal impacts if we continue to operate the lease site as is. Modest positive fiscal impacts anticipated in the future when this site comes under new ownership and has a modest redevelopment. It's one of our smallest sites on the waterfront, if not the smallest. It's on relatively modern lease terms now. Likely a redevelopment of the site will be a moderate expansion of the existing operation there, so some modest gains on rent. The current annual rent I reported previously to a council member today. I think my wife is correct. I do need glasses. I was reading my chart a little bit wrong. It was one line off. The rent we're getting out of it now is about $13,000. And this site hasn't historically hit percent gross rents. It usually grosses just under to get percentages. So that's where we are fiscally on this site. It's on pretty standard terms in terms of percent, 5% on retail and rentals and 10% on the one little slip that it has there. This lease, like I said earlier, expires at the end of September of this year. We've gone to council in the past several times as new developments occurred. Dennis, the existing leaseholder, initially was going to carry on and had a very modest proposal to do boardwalk and some other improvements. Then he decided he wanted to sell to and courted a couple of outside parties, couldn't come to terms with any outside parties to sell. Worked with the Bastons next door at the Gray's Inn as they were preparing to buy the Gray's Inn. That never came to pass, and so finally we brought to council, and council said RFP it. That was back in, I believe, October of 2015. Council stipulation out of that RFP, or out of that meeting, was bring the greatest return on investment possible, improve the view shed and facade, add to the overall tourist draw, restore and enhance the environment, and enhance the safety of the area. And council also wanted to investigate the possibility of locating an independent public restroom on this site. This RFP we modeled after other recent RFPs we've put out, basically use the same format, same template. The council's previous direction, as I just spoke, has been incorporated. I also bolstered up this RFP with financial and other business partner requirements that we've been talking to over consideration of the off-the-hook lease site and some of the wants that we've wanted out of that. I pulled it from various other RFPs and documents, leasing policies from other harbor communities, Santa Barbara, LA County, Port of San Diego being a couple of them. Some of the items that I've put in here and like say, bolstered up, full capitalization and proof of financial ability and resources to undertake whatever project they're proposing at the time of project proposal submittal. 10-year business plan and our 10-year pro forma and a business plan with standard business elements expected of such a plan, proven experience, capabilities, and history, disclosure of litigation or other disputes that could affect the ability to perform of the proposer, bank credit and landlord references, and examples of like commercial or other experience. Seeking council input on several areas of the RFP document and other areas that you may deem appropriate. Section 4A, which is on page 11 of the RFP document or page 46 of the council packet, which is the criteria for the selection of the proposer. Are these the correct elements? Are all the criteria we want to see represented? Is there any other desired elements we'd like to see? Also like to see some council input on section 4C, which is the selection methodology. That's on page 12 of the RFP document or 47 of the packet. Again, are these the correct elements? Is this the correct weighting? This is the scoring of the RFP proposers. Is this the correct scoring that we'd like to see? Are there other elements we'd also like to see? And then finally, section 5A3, which is the financial and business data we'd be looking for from proposers. Page 14 of the RFP, page 49 of the packet. Are these the correct materials and data that we'd like to see to properly vet a potential proposer coming along? Public restroom-wise, due to the very small size of this site, we're not recommending the RFP require building of a true public restroom on the site, but leave it a key element option in the RFP for proposers to get creative and see what they bring out of it, to see if such a restroom is practical. At a minimum, we would definitely be looking for any new leasee to be required to service their own customers. And if a standalone restaurant's not practical, a fallback could perhaps be a restroom being required like we have many of our other lease sites where it's just part of their lease site operation. And finally, we're seeking council direction on management of the site after the current lease's expiration. We're almost in all likelihood going to be going in. The lease will expire before we have a new tenant in place. What we're recommending is going through four possibilities. Possibility A, going to hold over the existing tenant until consent of landowner, COL, is granted the winning proposer, and then granting them an interim lease. There would be likely about a 1 to 3 month lag between those two occurrences. Could also go into holdover the existing tenant with the existing lease at current rent structure until the winning proposer obtains concept plan approval and negotiates a new lease, which is what we're recommending. Approximate 12 to 18 month lag there. The existing tenant, Dennis Kruger, as I believe I previously stated, is willing and would like to go into holdover for about another year. One, to kind of keep his skin in the game, but also to help us through any lag time so that we don't have an empty lease site. Another possibility, we have no master leaseholder after the lease expires and we operate It has a building lease until an interim lease executed with a winning proposer, meaning we go seek somebody to operate that building as is until such time as we get a winning proposer in place. Or we have no tenant after the current lease expires until a consent of landowner is issued and an interim lease executed, which would really mean no revenue in interim time, and that's probably not the best alternative. If approved, a timeline on this would be approximately we'd issue this RFP the end of this month, possibly early June. Proposals due about September 2018. Consent of landowner issued October of this year. Concept plan approval depend largely upon what sort of a proposal a proposer would come in with. Depending on complexity, potential concept plan approval be perhaps fall of next year, 2019, and then a new lease in place about fall or winter of 2019, which fits in about a year of operation with the existing tenant. Advertising, we'd go out to trade publications, commercial real estate listing sites, brokers, Craigslist, websites, Google Ads, social media, other such places that normally we'd advertise these things. And finally, anticipation of a question I'm probably going to get, why the lag time from when we last brought this to council in October 2015 to now. To be absolutely honest, I've had it on the back burner because I've had heavy workload and other things have taken precedence and jumped up in front of me and other more time-consuming issues, and it's just sat there simmering on the back burner. And with that, I'm ready for questions.
Okay, Eric, thanks for the staff report, and thanks for the candid comments at the end there. So I'll look to Red to start us off on questions. I've got one speaker slip when we get to public comment.
Okay, thanks, Eric. In the key objectives, one of those is to continue to provide bay access and ecotourism opportunities with kayak and other watercraft rentals and sales. Is that kind of what you expect as a response to the RFP?
Yes, and that was also, as we were going through the RFP, looking at putting this out to RFP, we went back to council. I believe that was one of council's wants or asks on that, was we wanted to keep keep the flavor of it, and that being the first kayak rental site that we had in town going back into the early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Wanted to keep that if possible and keep the bay visitor serving, low cost, easy access to the bay.
Okay. And do you know of anybody who has specific interest in this?
I do. Great question. I've had, I want to say, three existing leaseholders or subleaseholders in town that are interested, and probably two or three other outside entities or outside people that have expressed interest and are wondering when this might come up.
All right. And the nearest public restroom, is that up at Sandy Twist Paddleboard?
Oh, as far as leases go, the nearest true public restroom is going to be Centennial.
Oh, yeah.
The nearest lease...
Salt building.
Yeah, that's true. Salt building.
Okay, so there's not a great distance from here to a public restroom.
Not huge.
Okay. All right, that's all the questions I have.
Thanks. Matt?
Sure, Eric. In terms of moving forward, and if we go with this, or letter B in terms of the interim, is the... interim leaseholder, is how much time do you think, given the people who are interested in this site, to get a new lease, a COL in place, and a new lease agreement? Would that be a year and a half?
My seat in my pants tells me a year or less, just again depending on what sort of a redevelopment they propose. We're not asking scrape to the ground, start over, just leaving the site as is. And again, it's a very small site. There's not a lot of room for improvement there anyhow. So it's largely going to depend on the scale and scope of what sort of project somebody comes along with. You know, the typical concept plan approval, coastal commission, 6 to 8 months, 9 months, maybe longer, depending on how things are queued up with the city and with coastal.
And that, I guess that'll also determine any and all, if there are improvements on the Harbor Walk, and then any sort of docks, and they're on their bay side of the property?
Correct. Obviously, that'll, at least the bay side, I think, would add some complexity. it's going to be a given they're going to be required to do the Harbor Walk. The Harbor Walk is going to be slightly more complex there because it's at a lower level. As you know, it came in lower at the VLA lease site, the lease site where the paddleboard company is. So coming through Gray's Inn, they've already anticipated it coming across. It's a little lower than grade there, and then through Kayak Horizons, they're either going to have to somehow step it up through Kayak Horizons and then get up to the street end or come up with a plan. So it's going to be slightly more complex.
Okay. And also, then I have a question about the RFP. Is now where you'd like us to ask you questions about the commentary or questions for the RFP?
Yeah, all your questions.
Well, I'm just, if it fits into Eric's.
Sure, however you want.
Okay, we're looking at on page 34, looking at A, B, and C. You just went through the different sections. In terms of where you pointed them out, where they are in the proposal, are these standard requests for you to ask of possible leaseholders, or are you trying to introduce anything new? And if you're not, are you satisfied with these, or would you like any sort of suggestions?
Which page are you at in the RFP?
I'm actually on the second page of the staff report.
Okay.
And where you've listed the different sections that you're asking for input.
Oh, so those are the sections that, if I was to have a template RFP, these would be amongst a couple others, but these are sort of the main sections that would change depending on what the site is and what we wanted to see.
Mm-hmm.
So these are where I wanted to make sure we're hitting what we want to hit in terms of what we want to see, how we want to vet a methodology, we want to vet a proposer, what financially and other parameters we want to look at when we vet those folks.
Okay, so that leads me to when you talked about the methodology and the point system. Are you content with those questions and the points for each one?
I'm content. I try to weight them based on historical what we've done and largely, you know, how we went through the off the hook process and the bumps and whatnot we went through in that process. Just trying to get weighting to where I think the council wanted to see prioritization. It's not set in stone by any means. Obviously,
sure.
It's all draft.
And then likewise on page 46 of the entire packet, we're looking at section 4 A, and then looking at the various selection, the criteria. Does this criteria change with every different lease, or is this selective to this small site and to the water side of the property that might be getting into action?
These items are going to change per site and per what we want to see to a degree. These are somewhat stock, quote unquote, criteria, but they can also morph, and they will be obviously looked at. You know, when you look at best balance between uses and requirements in the city's general plan, local coastal plan, zoning ordinances, building codes, design elements. Well, that's going to change dramatically between a large site with some room to do different things or a little corner site like this that may not be a candidate for a huge redevelopment. So it's going to be tailored to the individual site when we come to evaluate.
And then last question, knowing that you have a existing tenant that could stay there, would this be month to month just in case you have a new tenant coming in that
yes.
you might have to rush this existing tenant out of there? And is this existing tenant, he's been there for a while, will he be able to leave on short notice?
Obviously we don't want any 30 months sorry you're gone. I mean, we need to plan it out and have some sort of surety. He's going to need some sort of surety, so we'll negotiate that and figure out what works best for both of us. Would be okay. 9 and 10.
Alright, great, Matt, thanks. John?
Thanks, Eric, for the report, and thanks for answering the questions earlier that I sent over. I appreciate that. With regard to your questions, section 4A, a criteria for selection of a proposer. I had to find what page it's on.
46 of the packet.
Thank you. So many notes here. Oh, yeah, I pulled it out right here in front of me. All right, I just had one suggestion on the third bullet point. I thought they were great criteria, by the way.
demonstrated financial capability, capacity, and capitalization at the time of submitting proposal to undertake the redevelopment and maintain the ongoing operation successfully. I'm looking for cash flow there, being fully able to.
So noted.
So noted, thank you. I thought the remainder were quite good. Section 4C, selection methodology. I would up the points on item number 6, bringing financial benefit to the city. I might take some points from 4 and move it to 6. That's up to you, but that'd be my recommendation. I don't know how the rest of council might feel about that, but I would more heavily weight including financial benefit to the city. I'd like to see that. And then,
John, I'm just keeping notes. You're on 4 and 6.
Yes,
of that,
page number 48.
Okay.
Item 6. My recommendation would be to increase the points allocated to financial benefit to the city. And
so
the possible
10 points.
Yeah, recommendation would be decreasing item number 4 from 30 points to something less, and increasing item number 6 to something greater than 20 points, 10 points, excuse me.
Makes sense. So
yeah,
one way to enable that could be in the RFP document and in the evaluation and in the lease ultimately is, assuming it's not a great grand redevelopment that's going to cost millions of dollars because you're going to have a hard time spending that much.
Right.
You're not going to be investing a hell heck of a lot of money into it, so right. Pay a little more rent. I mean, that's increasing the financial benefit.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep. And then
do you have a points scheme?
Oh, so
that?
I'd raise it to 20 points. My suggestion would be raise 6
20
to
and
20 points and 20 on
okay.
Number 4. Yeah.
Sorry,
but
John, I'm just trying to keep notes
first. I was trying
first.
To be yep. less prescriptive.
Yep. Thanks.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then great job on section 4A3 financial and business data. I know I made probably a lot of those comments before regarding these leases, and I think you've captured it well, and that's page number, you'll find it, Eric, before I do, but
50.
What is it?
50.
Yeah, 50. But I thought it was well done, so that's perfect. The other questions that I had with regard to just the general format were these. Pardon me while I pull the right notes out. There it is. Section B, page 7 of your RFP.
Page 42 of the packet.
Page 42 of the packet. The investigation responsibility of the for the seawall at revetment. What happens if during due diligence issues are found, and who's responsible? So if it's the proposer's responsibility to assess the seawall and revetment, what if during that assessment they determine that there are failure issues or issues that need to be repaired? What comes out of that, and who's responsible?
It would currently the existing leasehold is responsible, like most of our leases, and I would purport that we would put that on the proposer to address it in their proposal.
So if I were, not that I'm not going to, but if I was going to respond to the RFP and I found that the seawall was failing, I would be expected to fix it before I entered into a lease. I'm not sure. Or
as part of the proposal, overall proposal, to do whatever they propose to do. There is no seawall there. It's all revetment.
A revetment, yeah.
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 And there's no issues identified there that we're aware of at this point. But
okay.
You're correct. But somebody could do due diligence and discover something.
Yeah.
If they discovered something, I would, my answer would be, you know, if somebody discovers something and they determine, well, there's, you know, $500,000 worth of rock work there, they're going to throw that into their proposal for redeveloping the site and factor that in for how much they're going to have to invest in to continue on with that site.
Is that revetment the lessee's responsibility once they assume the lease, or is it the lessor's responsibility on an ongoing basis? I'm trying to understand.
Lessee.
Yeah, the lessee, the person that assumes the lease.
Yes.
Okay.
Correct.
Us, the lessor, we're leasing the property or the whose responsibility is it? Our revetment as the lessor, like right now, with the current lessee. If it broke, who has to fix it? It's a legal question, and it's important because of other leases.
Because it's part of the property, the lessor owns it, but pursuant to the lease, it's the lessee's responsibility, both the current lessee, because of the current lease, it's the current lessee's responsibility to fix it, and any new lease would have the then current lessee responsible to fix it.
Okay. And so then, and where I was going with that, I appreciate that. That helps clarify it. If somebody was responding to the RFP and they went through the process and they found a $500,000 issue, obviously they're not going to, I would assume, want to continue on with the process. Just to be clear, it would be their responsibility if they found it then.
Correct. And yeah. I wouldn't necessarily assume they would want to continue on. It's just going to be an investment they're going to have to make, and they may we
might get some concessions.
Yeah, they
for
may
that.
Want some concessions or less rent break or something, or longer lease term to amortize it out over time.
I didn't mean to belabor that. I was just trying to understand commensurate liability with regard to that and both pre- and post-submission. Page 10 of the RFP, I had, let's see, go back and find that now. Here it is.
45.
Under C, Section C, let's see. The city reserves the right to amend the RFP process and the selection procedures at any time, even after it's let. Would that be true?
Yeah.
Should we deem?
Is that normal?
Yes, that
okay.
Would be true.
Necessary,
okay.
Yes.
Just trying to understand it. Yeah, that's normal. Great. Page 11, third bullet point. I already gave that to you. Thank you. Adding the ongoing operation. And my last one was page 13, increasing the weight, and you've already got that. And so, great. Other than that, I have no other questions. Thank you.
All right, John Marlis.
You kind of slipped into discussion there, John, but I'm gonna stick with questions. Well, I'm going to come back later, right, to give my opinions about how to change the scoring. I had the opportunity to meet with Eric, so I had most of my questions answered, and some of the others have already been asked. I was curious to know if we could enlarge that site in any way by adding part of that parking, if that was a possibility or something that if somebody proposed we could consider, or would that be a different RFP if we were going to do something like that?
If somebody proposed that out of the blue, so to speak, we can always consider it. Council could direct that tonight if we so wanted to go that way to gain some more space, much like we did with the aquarium.
But we would need to do it now, I'm assuming. It has to be a level playing field, so if we're suggesting that that's a possibility, we would need to at least include that in the RFP. I guess I'm wondering if there's any other type of operation, any other kind of business that would consider operating there, or is it really going to be mostly a boat, kayak, canoe, paddleboard rental?
Well, if we flavor the RFP to kind of hem it into that sort of use, then we're hemming it into that sort of use. If someone were to want to come in and, you know, being a small site, let's say we don't expand it, pretty limited in what you can do. Even if you expand it, unless you go pretty significantly over into that street end, and it's the yacht club on the other side there.
Right.
Nobody of which owns the parking. There's a small driveway there at Kayak Horizons, so you've lost the one or two parking spaces that are sort of normally there that service that driveway into Kayak Horizons. Even if we were, let's say, to expand over into the parking spaces, it's not adding a lot of space. It's adding some. it could potentially open it up for more possibilities. We could put that in there as a potential option, but that's going to be a council decision and policy decision for whether we want to do that. And then what do we do with the existing parking that's already there that we're now effectively taking away?
Yeah, it, the city owns the parking, though, correct?
Yes, that's all.
Well, right. So
Rob's got, I don't know if that's right away or what that technically is, that space.
Well, it was just a question because it's one of those things where when these lease sites come up, we tend to think of exactly what's already there or something similar. And I'm just wondering if we're going to change the Embarcadero in any way, we would have to be more creative about the spaces and what else we might want there. So I'm not suggesting we do that, and especially given that it's a tight timeline and you've got interested people, which was another question that I had asked you. I was curious if there were people interested in. So I think, you know, it was more of a question. And I also then asked about the length of the lease. I don't know how long the current lease was there, but in terms of the length of the lease that you might be considering in the future?
The existing lease was 23 years.
Uh-huh.
Future lease, again, depends on level of development / redevelopment and what lease terms they wanted to jump into.
So that's negotiable.
It's negotiable. Again, it's not a place where you're going to invest $2 million, I don't think, unless there's something really big and ugly hidden underneath there that gets uncovered. But I would anticipate somewhere in 20 to 30-year range, given the amount of investment someone's going to have to do to get up and operating, assume they operate with the existing building or maybe expand on it. So they're not going to be investing lots and lots. But it depends on what sort of terms they want to enter into and whether they advance our revenue out of it. If we can get more revenue out of it over the long term, we would consider going in a longer term lease.
All right, thanks. Thank you. I'll wait.
Okay, great. Those are great questions. I'm just going to go ahead and open it up for public comment. Jane, come on up. Thanks for waiting.
Thank you. Gene Dowdy, 201 Main Street. I'm an architect. I've been looking at this project for a number of years. I talked to Dennis at one time, and we almost reached an agreement with it. I have just a couple of questions for this resolution or
RFP.
And they would mostly go to Eric. One would be for the parking. In your statement, you said that there are X amount of parking available. I'm sure that number is available somewhere, and I would think that would be in the RFP so that everybody know what existing parking has been established for that site there. There was a Big Mama 1, Big Mama 2 there when Hill's Landings were there, and there's a formula to figure out how many parking spaces can go there. So, and then number two, I don't remember whether Dennis ever got a water lease assessment of his revetment and docks. I might have done it, but I don't even remember. But because they all look alike after a while, believe me. But the docks are pretty poor shape. The revetment is marginal, in my opinion. So there's going to be some significant amount of money put in on the revetment. And then I don't know whether there's been any structural analysis or review of the building itself. The building's very old. I've looked at it quite a bit. In my professional opinion, I think it's at the point where you got to knock it down and start over. So I see a substantial amount of money going into the lease site. So you're going to have to figure out how to make it pay for itself. Number three, my comment would be about in the one of the comments that any material submitted to the RFP becomes property of the city. And as I discussed with Eric earlier, I'd be concerned about intellectual propriety. I had come up with a design for the Harbor Walk to figure out how to meet that street level, but I would hate to give that proposal to the city and then maybe not get the project, and then somebody else said, well, look, that's a good idea. I think I'll incorporate that. So I would think that somehow I've got to protect myself on that design. Number four, one of the comments on there is the project would be scaled at 1 inch equals 40 feet. Well, the project's only 30 feet wide, so that means the drawing's only like 3/4 inch wide. So that scale needs to be changed. And five, there's been lots of money will have to be spent on that project, and that's going to be the bones of it. So it's a small site. If you guys have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thanks, Gene. Okay. Appreciate it. Okay. All right, with that, I don't have any more speaker slips. We'll close public comment and bring it back to council for a discussion, and we'll start to the left. I'm going to the left tonight. Red, if you want to just lead us off.
I don't really have anything to add to the RFP. It seems to me to cover what we've asked for in the past, so I'm satisfied to proceed with it.
Okay, good. Matt?
I agree the RFP is ready to go, and also I agree with going with a month-to-month with the existing tenant.
Okay, John?
Yeah, thanks. You know, Gene, thanks for making those comments. To me, this is a tough one to pencil out, and I'm just making commentary. I don't know. Maybe there are people out there that can do it. And maybe I should have asked this during questions, but my thoughts are, my goodness, the proximity of the lessee to next door, possibly. Bringing this together, I don't know if there's any interest there, if you've had any discussions, but I guess I should have asked about that earlier. I'm concerned about the economics of it all. If there are revetment issues that have to be addressed, it looks like a teardown. To me, as I think Gene stated that, it's old. The dock needs work, as he said, and I don't know how economically viable it is, and if there might need to be special consideration that somebody responds to the lease RFP. I guess at that time we can look at that. So my summary is that, boy, it's tough, but if we do want to go out for RFP, I would agree that we should try that, and I'm okay with the month-to-month lease as well with the current and existing business. So,
Marlos.
Yeah. I'm good to go with the proposal. I did have some recommended changes to the selection methodology, and similar to what John mentioned, I would like to see an increase in both the lease terms and including the financial benefit to the city.
Can you go to the page so we can follow you?
Sure. Page
Thanks.
13 of the proposal 48.
Okay.
And I also would like to see an increase in the overall proposal and team qualifications and experience.
Are you on 12 then? On which number are you on then? Page 7? Okay, all right.
13? Yes.
Yeah, page 13,
yes.
Sorry.
Yes, number 7. And again, I think I would also take it from the proposal that includes key objectives. It seems to me that when you look at your criteria for selection, more of it seems to be related to the finances, the experience, the business plan, meeting our needs, as opposed to the project objectives per se. So anyway, that's my suggestion.
So can we?
So I would go 15 and 15 and take it.
15 and 15 on what?
On the Bennett. 6 and 7, so up from 10 to 15 and take it from number 4. Reduce
number
that
four
to 20.
Number 6, 15, number 7.
Right, that would be my recommendation.
Okay.
And I'm also good with month to month with the existing leaseholder.
Okay. So what's on the, for the page 13 of the RFP, what I got from discussion from both John and Marlis was on the qualification. So item number 4, we would adjust to 20 points, and then 6 would be 15 points, and 7 would be 15 points. That's what we got out of that. Is there any debate or discussion on that? It's all right. Okay, so we agree on that. So then, top of page 13, the points for that. Number 4 is change that to a rating of 20 points. And then number 6 is 15 points. And then number 7 is 15 points. That's what I just got from the discussion, and there's agreement up here for all that? Okay. And then there was consensus on going with B in the B on page 35 of the staff report.
Staff report, correct.
Which would be going to holdover. So I what I got was everybody's agreed on the recommendation B, as in boy, which I would agree with as well. And then could you a couple of the notes from Gene on the proprietary information and scale. So it seems like we could probably adjust the scale thing in the RFP to for the drawings that would be submitted. Can we?
Absolutely.
All right. And then the proprietary information, I'm looking for Joe on the comments there. So there's concern on the RFP and retaining some proprietary information on drawings submitted or plans submitted. How can we address that? Would you recommend that?
I wouldn't recommend that, but if you want to do it, we can just change the language that the architect retains the rights that the architect has. And therefore, if the city wants to use those plans, we'd only be able to do it with the architect's permission.
Okay. Is there any discussion on that? I mean, we just want to get good proposals on this. We don't want to eliminate anything.
And just understand that if the, although the speaker may disagree, if a plan was submitted and then another person just made a little tweak but then drew their own plans, they probably would be okay with doing that anyway. So I'm not sure how much right they keep after having submitted the proposal. But that's an argument.
And that's not something that we've really gone into in the past. I mean, this is very standard what we were dealing with.
Yes.
I would just go along with what we have and trust that the process works out. And then I've got one other comment as far as for council discussion. You know, we've, having gone through some discussions on lease sites, and some of the information in there, we're asking for financial information. In one of our last discussions, we were doing the lease site on, I guess it was off the hook, and it was difficult for us to go through the discussions on the financials in open session, nor were they necessarily provided. I think we have in the past having these discussions in closed session, and I would want to have that discussion with council to be able to do that, because the financials, when we get into any of those discussions, aren't something that, as would be in a private transaction, that wouldn't be something that should be revealed or redacted. And I think we've waited a lot on that in previous discussions. So I would want to have some discussion on, if we're reviewing these, that we have the ability to do that in closed session because of confidential information regarding finances. And I think that's appropriate and legal, and I just that's the discussion I want to have with council, and I'm looking to our city attorney to advise on that as well.
I agree that some financial information is confidential, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you could discuss in closed session the weight that you want to give the financial information that it's given and how you may feel about the financial information. You could certainly keep the, not have to describe to a penny what the financial information is, but the discussion of you deciding whether or not you're comfortable with the financial information really needed part of the public discussion, so the public understands why you did or didn't do something.
And I'm not trying to avoid any of that, but I think that it was difficult and both uncomfortable for our previous applicants, and I just think we need to be able to be more diligent. Those are my comments, and I want to open that up for discussion and just wait to see how everybody else feels, and with your advice, legal advice, please.
But if you have questions of the person who submits the financials, you could discuss that in closed session, but not with the person who submitted the financials. You'd have to give your negotiator some direction as to changes you wanted, then that'd be part of the negotiation. But again, you're not negotiating their financial information. You're negotiating whether or not you want to enter into a lease with that person. So I'm not sure. Other than understanding it's uncomfortable to talk about finances. But the discussions you had with that person, you had to have had an open session.
Yes.
So could I weigh in?
Yes.
I understand the difficulty and the discomfort, because it was a very uncomfortable conversation, but I don't know. It's my understanding that with regard to a response to an RFP, it has to be publicly vetted because it's a public process. It has to be open. And those kinds of questions, when they don't appear in either a staff report or they're not made known to the detail that's necessary to make a decision on the financial acumen of any individual who's responding to an RFP, I personally would want the opportunity to represent the community openly, and I think that's required. I would assume that that's required. So the negotiation, once an RFP is let and responded to and accepted, then the lease negotiation occurs in closed session, if I'm not incorrect, and then that's a different process, though.
Right, because that's the terms that you're going to agree to with them, not whether or not they're qualified.
Right.
Okay, if everybody's cool, I'm good with it the way it is. So we're in agreement with the ratings and the points on what was laid out, and we have consensus on B. Okay. Was there anything else then? Is that all you need? And then we need to make a motion to approve the RFP at that?
Sure. I would move approval of the RFP for lease site 6262W and authorize advertising the approved RSP as amended this evening. I would also include a recommendation to go into a month-to-month holdover agreement with the existing tenant as outlined in the conclusion section of the staff report.
And B, conclusion B? Is that specific to
conclusion B?
Yes. Motion by Mr. Heading, second by Ms. McPherson. Any further discussion? None. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? None. Motion carries 5-0. Great. Moving on to item C3. Item C3 is the adoption of Resolution 3018 and Resolution Number 3118, approving the Adopt Morro Bay and Memorial Programs and Direction regarding a Master Plan for Street Furniture. Janine, thanks for taking the time to come back and visit us.
Thank you and good evening. Tonight, you're going over the proposed adoption and memorial programs again. At your March meeting, you reviewed the what was at that point a proposed adopt a park, adopt a street, and memorial programs for benches, trees, and bicycle racks, and had provided some additional direction to staff with making some changes to the adoption program and the memorial program relating to safety and volunteer identification, orientation of volunteers, signage, budgeting, reimbursement process, as well as seeing if there was a way to combine all the programs into the adoption programs into one and include other collaborative effort kind of adoptions like the Del Mar restroom renovation project that recently was completed. In addition, with regard to the memorial programs, council had noted that that you wanted some flexibility with the benches and in terms of the types of material, as you may have some different locations requiring or necessitating different types of material. So down at the Rock parking lot area where it gets very blasted with the salt air and the marine environment, different type of material may be warranted versus somewhere in the downtown area, not needing as such more heavy long-term type of construction material. So with the street furniture master plan that's being recommended, we would be including that flexibility in there and address those issues for the benches in with that. So what staff has done and what you have before you tonight is a new resolution for each of the adoption program and the memorial programs, as well as new proposed policies with revisions that were made to address the issues that council raised at your last meeting for how the adoption program would work, the draft agreement between the city and the adopting organization, as well as combining the application into one application for the adopted public area that's being requested. The budget, your draft budget for 18-19 included a $5,000 line item that was conceptually approved for some of those miscellaneous items that would be reimbursable, such as plant material and whatnot, that the city would do a call for projects after the budget is adopted in July, and then bring to the Public Works Advisory Board a presentation of whatever applications are received at their August meeting, and then include any of the amounts that get approved by the city into the volunteer agreements between the city and the adopter. So Resolution 30-18 includes the adoption program, as well as the revised program policies, a new application, and draft agreement. With regard to the memorial program, memorial tree, bench, and bike rack program, we've added that flexibility in the street furniture master plan. In addition, we are also recommending changes for the remainder of 17-18's fiscal year, the master fee schedule, based on the adoption of the master fee schedule that you did for 18-19 and changing the fees to be on a cost plus time and materials basis rather than a specified item amount, so that if when we do the furniture plan that we have different types of material makeup for benches, those obviously would have a different cost, and that would be reflected in having it just be cost plus time and materials. So resolution number 31-18 is in regards to the memorial programs and the revised program policies and applications for those, as well as a proposed recommended change for the fee structure for the remainder of the 17-18 master fee schedule time period. With that, I'd like to turn it over to the council for any questions, comments, and a final direction.
Thank you, Janine. Looking for questions. I don't have any public comment speaks at this time, but Ray, do you want to start us off for questions? And if there's
sure.
anybody for public comment after questions, we'll call them up.
Okay, yeah, thank you. I appreciate the work you've done on this.
But I do have a question about Resolution 3118, which is page 11 of the staff report, the Memorial Bench Program. Everything listed on that page is geared toward the massive stone benches that were placed down near the rock that have space for three plaques. And we did ask for a furniture, what did we call it, a master plan for street furniture that will include flexibility in the type of benches. So I'm not sure that this resolution reflects that direction. And I wonder if I'm misreading it somehow.
The resolution itself, or are you talking about the policy on page 11?
The resolution.
Attachment 1, red.
How about if we...
Page 72?
Yeah, page 72.
Suggestion? We could remove the word concrete from the whereas a new fee structure for memorial concrete benches needs to be established and remove the word concrete?
I'm looking at... not the resolution. It's attachment 1 to the resolution, page 11 or page 72. If requester applies for one plaque space and an existing bench is not available, it would be placed on a waiting list until there are enough plaque requests to fill one memorial bench. If you have a small memorial bench that's going on a sidewalk in front of a shop, it may not have... Are you envisioning that that is going to have a space for three plaques as well? I just need to clarify this in my mind.
It potentially could. If you look at a lot of the existing memorial benches that are like the wood slatted ones, like along the harbor walk, they are long enough to accommodate more than one plaque. But we could certainly change the language to make it not number specific, so that if it is a bench that is capable, so if in the downtown area a bench is recommended or an option for that, has more than one plaque space, but it may not be three, it might be two, it might be four. We can certainly change the language to make that not as number specific.
Okay. I just question how specific we want to make this when we're looking for flexibility. And then on the two subsequent pages, 12 and 14, the applications for memorial bench and memorial tree, in the center where it says under plaque to read the shaded part, it still says please print legibly instead of print on both of those.
Sorry about that. I thought I had caught them.
That's all my questions.
And on the, going back to the language on attachment 1 on number 3, mm-hmm. we can reword that to address it where if it's a little more vague. So it's referring again to the master street furniture, or the furniture street furniture master plan. And if that bench has more than one space capability, that they would be put on a wait list until there's enough spaces to fill that bench.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you.
Matt? Yes, looking at this, looking at on the staff recommendation number 3, when we talk about benches, bike racks, and other memorial objects, does this also include fire pits that can be placed down at the rock? We had one down there now, but we have some others that could be placed. Is this the proper place to put the verbiage in? Or do we have any suggestions of where that might go?
Are you asking council?
Fire pit's not a street.
We didn't anticipate a memorial fire pit program. But if council directs so, we could have a memorial fire pit program.
And so I guess asking a question, if this is not the proper time or place in this process for fire pits, where would they, when would that come up? Or if this is the proper place, well, I mean, we can, I can see plaques on fire pits.
I'll leave that to council to decide and give us direction.
Okay. All right. Great. John?
No questions.
Marlis?
I just have a couple questions. I was noticing on the application, this is for the volunteer program, that you asked for first, second, and third choice, and I know that there are organizations that actually work in multiple places in the city, and I'm wondering how you will handle something like that. Would that be an amendment to an existing agreement, or would you let them propose some additional spots that they wanted to work in?
You mean if there were more than three spaces?
Well, you asked for first, second, and third choice, and I'm just wondering if I assume that was in case you had competition for a space and you were only going to give them one. I'm wondering what if they, how would you handle if one of the organizations says, oh, I want to work here, 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 and here, four spaces, let's say.
If I was submitting this application, in my first choice, I would put see attached list of okay. locations that we're proposing to work at, and we would evaluate that. I'm not sure that there's going to be a competition for locations.
Yeah. Well, I think just to make it clear that they can propose more
yes.
than one
yes.
would be my suggestion.
Yes.
Then,
and maybe we could add submit attachments as necessary to that
whatever,
section.
Just
yeah.
so that they
yeah.
know.
Yeah. Okay.
Don't stop them with one if they want to do two, three, four spots, which I know there are some that actually do.
Yes.
And then a second question. Now, I noticed that in the requirements for the bikes, you have the powder blue bike racks. But we have new bike racks down on the Embarcadero that aren't that. So maybe you could explain
yeah, we have
how
one
we got those
that
fish.
Matches my bike perfectly. So
well, I love the fish bike racks, so, but somehow we now have an exception to the rule. So I'm just wondering how we got that.
So Jeannie and I were talking about that in the audience, and we're going to add the same language we have for benches that consistent with the furniture master plan program to not limit the design of bike racks to the standard peak rack.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Okay. I guess my questions are really along the same lines. When we design when we do the master plan, I guess that was the purpose behind it, is so we would have some consistency in the furniture. So I don't quite understand why we wouldn't be. So what's the purpose of having the furniture master plan if we don't really seem to care what style bench or
well, I think
rack or what?
The furniture master plan would set up specific standards for materials, colors, functionality of the whatever the piece of furniture is, so that we don't end up with benches that cannot support an appropriate load. That you know, you have a spot for three people to sit, but it won't actually support three people. Like if you were to buy a home style garden bench, some of those aren't designed to for being out in the public. So we won't want a minimum level of materials to ensure that we're safe. We want to be consistent with our downtown and waterfront plans that were just reviewed so that we have consistent street furniture there. But the, for example, the harbor supplied fish bike rack is functional. I love the color. It matches my bike. And it's in an appropriate location. So I think that could be approved.
I just find it interesting that, so how do you determine whether or not it's, you know, I shouldn't belabor that.
We'll have a plan that will specify materials of construction, appropriate colors, and give examples. And as long as you fit within that larger box, rather than just saying it has to be a concrete bench or a peak rack, give some flexibility there that if you meet the performance requirements and the colors that we've picked for those areas, that is an acceptable product to use.
And so the document that's developed will be developed by staff?
Correct.
Okay. And so what guidelines do you all have to select these? I mean, when I think about the waterfront master plan, how does that delineate what style we pick versus the downtown or North Morro Bay?
I can probably speak to more of the materials and the functionality. Style and color are a bit subjective to the selector, but we do have guidelines that in the recently approved downtown plan that talk about, you know, the style mm-hmm. of the downtown.
So is that the answer, that those will be kind of the guidelines?
Those will be the guidelines for those documents. We need to be internally consistent with the documents.
Okay.
And they have to be functional, and they have to be able to stand up to our environment and stand up to use.
Okay.
And to complete that thought, we should probably have design standards that are in the master plan, or whatever we're calling it, and council will have an opportunity to review that and approve that, correct?
Correct. Okay. It'll go to PWAB and then come forward to council.
Okay. And one more, back to Councilmember McAwitsky's point about the fire pits. We owe council an item on that because the future agenda was set, you know, months ago. So we owe the item to come back. If council doesn't want to add that fire pits to the resolution now, but in the future council says it's okay to add more fire pits to said location, depending on how you could also amend this or this resolution to include fire pits, or you can do that now.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then my other question on the line item for the $5,000 that was budgeted, and Janine, you were saying for landscape material, so if you get a call for a project, we don't have any, there's nothing really limiting that. I mean, I heard you say there would be landscaped, and I think that was what prompted this, was landscape material for planting. Could that expand into a bike rack and other elements? My understanding was we were, the line item was for adopt a park and some of those beautifications where it was landscape material, and if it's not delineated, I would want to delineate that, if that seems to be a question.
No, I don't think that was a question. My understanding from the last discussion was that the line item was specifically related to the adoption program, not the adoption programs or the memorial programs. The memorial programs, the individual requesting the memorial or applying for the memorial is the one that's paying for that.
I understand.
The city's not reimbursing for any of those costs. So the $5,000 line item, and I don't know what exactly the specific line item title is, but my understanding was that was for the adoption programs and would be written into the actual agreement that if a particular adopter requested during the call for projects a certain amount of funding for purchasing of plants that they would be putting through in the planter boxes or something that the city wasn't providing, that that would be the amount that would be approved. Here's the reimbursement process for that, and it cannot exceed that amount.
So what other mechanisms are there? Because we have volunteer organizations, I think we spend time on these types of subject. So the other part of that is we need to inform all of our organizations that this is available to them if they want to enhance theirs. And so it's not, okay, we've only got three applicants, we're going to allow all $5,000 for that. I think we should have some limits and let the program grow a little bit before we, you know, have one particular, you know, whether it's an organization or project, be all encompassed by one ask. I think we need
Correct.
Yeah, and I just want to make sure
Rob
that
Rob and I had talked about that previously, is that we wouldn't perhaps allocate all of the 5,000 at one time in this initial call, that it might be half of that, and then reserving a certain portion of that and doing a separate call later in the year. After we get all these agreements together, get them up and running, and they're getting going and seeing what are their actual needs that they may have, that they may.
I know it won't be perfect, but because of the organizations, you know, we'll probably get some feedback, you know, if you know, whether or not it was allocated appropriately and as we go on. So we'll learn from it. But I'm just asking the questions to address some of those concerns.
And just to add on that, Mayor, it's specified in page 2, the call for programs is July. For projects would be July. Submitted applications, August. Any amounts approved by council would follow that. So would there be a defined period, and then that would establish it for the year, whoever responded and developed a scope of work? That would define the budget that was...
That's the proposal.
I remember that as the discussion.
Yes.
It's not an open all year long thing.
No,
where
it's
you
not
can
open
come back
all year long.
Yeah.
It's open for a defined period to be kind of fair to everybody, that we would call for projects. They would be evaluated, rated, and we'd bring a recommendation.
Okay. Sure.
I see your point, Jamie, in terms of instead of having one open period, should we put in there that there will be two periods? There's be one in this July and then to be finished in August, and perhaps another to be decided, requests to be made in January and then to be decided on in February. That way it gives different groups different times to do it, and or chronologically speaking, to be spread out through the year. Just an idea.
I would favor that.
Anybody have other comments? Okay. I'd support that. Any other discussion items on this? Matt, I know you brought up the fire pits. Don't want to ignore that, but do we? I don't know if there was much bite on that from that. Whether or not we want to just come back with the item, you know, at a later date.
I am totally fine with that. If we want to come back, I just wanted to bring it up. Yeah. Looking at this, that these are going to be the improvements that we have with our benches at the Rock, and this and those fire pits had been part of a plan, but they hadn't been brought to council, so I just wanted to make sure that we bring them up if we want to settle it now, but I can sense we don't. I'm just going out on a limb here. You know, I don't mind doing it at a future date either.
Okay. Is there any other sensing going on?
I just wanted to make sure that when you develop the standards for the benches, that in addition to maintenance and durability and all of those things, ability to withstand the weather, et cetera, that you include comfort. Right. That's it.
You better be careful what you say.
Put reasonable in there. And then reasonable in there, and I think we'd be okay. Did we cover everything? And so basically there were some requests there on some changes. Do you want to just cover that real quickly, Janine, and then we can maybe support a motion to approve everything with the stated changes?
Go ahead, Janine.
So I've got Marlis's comment that in the standards for the street furniture master plan to include reasonable comfort as well as all the other items that was talked about, safety, durability, longevity. Matt had indicated, and there was consensus for supporting to having two calls for projects. First one being in July, and I think the second one coming up in the in like the January time frame.
January, and then to be approved a month apart.
And then we are not doing anything about fire pits at the moment.
Bike racks would have an acceptable alternative to the peak rack that would be consistent with our street furniture master plan.
Can I add in that as we go, you know, acceptable alternative. I think there needs to be some assurances, and maybe that's in the furniture guide or plan, that it's placed in a way that it doesn't get in public right-of-way. And we shouldn't be – these are great, but we don't want to be littering the pedestrian walkways, and I think that's part of it too. We want to be able to have thorough pedestrian walkways, and if a piece of furniture or bike rack doesn't fit, then we should be able to identify that. And does that need to be stated clearly?
Correct.
There?
We have other existing codes that cover that about not obstructing and maintaining minimum clearances.
Okay. All right.
And we can use the same language on page 11 under the bench where we talk about referring to the street furniture master plan regarding information on types of benches available. We can use that same language in the bike, but just replacing benches with bikes. And then when we do the street master plan, those more specific details of location, density, material type, color, those kinds of things would be in the plan as opposed to spelled out in the policy. Then let's see.
Oh, and correct Pring to print.
And what?
Pring to print. It's a typo in the application
okay,
form.
All right. Okay.
And then on the application for the Adopt Morro Bay application, Marlis had indicated about the having more than one location potential and the suggestion for adding language to include a list of all locations that the adopter may wish if it's more than just one. And I think the last one I have noted is with regard to page 11, the memorial bench number 3, just modifying that language to referring to the street furniture master plan with regard to benches and the number of plaque spaces, and if the bench is to accommodate more than one plaque space, you would be put on a wait list until there's enough to be able to do the bench at one time.
And what about Matt's suggestion on the open period? Did you already cover that? Okay, all right, good.
Rob, you would also caught on resolution 3118 to remove the word concrete bench. Is that
yes.
something that there's agreement to take?
Yes,
that
we
out
could
of the
just yeah. remove the word concrete. And
thank you, Dana. Okay. It's always interesting how much time we'll spend on these types of things. And we'll, again, I'm sure. anything else? None?
And the last one, I don't know if we mentioned this already, but on page 15, the racks with plaques, bike rack program, under the rack, changing that language to what I mentioned was using the bench language. So instead of it listing racks are to be purchased from peak racks, It would be that referring to the street furniture master plan for the types of bike racks.
And so was there something in there that said they had to be powder-coated blue? Did that, was that part of the discussion as well?
That was part of the initial council's initial approval of the program.
Program was powder-coated blue as part of that original council approval of.
And then other bike racks could be various colors. I mean, that's what the other fish bike rack that you're talking about is your bike color. So I mean, we have nothing that really establishes anything other than the peak racks have to be blue.
Correct.
Okay, and that's okay.
I think that is okay.
Okay. All right. I'm just thinking that someday that'll probably come back to us and ask for some other color is all. That's a, you know, okay.
Yes.
Okay. All right. We're all good?
Good.
Yeah. We've got everything covered. I think thanks for repeating that. So we could take a motion to approve this item as amended.
So you want
us to read it?
Sure.
Sure.
Go ahead.
All right. I move that we adopt resolution number 30-18 establishing an Adopt Morro Bay program and adopt resolution number 31-18 rescinding resolution numbers 40-90 and 0400 and establishing a memorial tree, bench, and bike rack program in parks and public rights of way as amended and direct staff to prepare a street furniture master plan to designate location, density, type, and number of benches, bike racks, and other memorial objects to be placed in city parks, rights of way, and other public places. And return in 6 months? Within 6 months to council for approval.
Second.
Motion by Ms. McPherson, and so we have the motion didn't include the amendments. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
Did.
All right. Okay. Pardon me.
If I could note that the six-month time frame is when we would have something available to take to the advisory body first.
Ah.
So, council would follow that then.
Okay. Then,
if that is acceptable.
Yes. Can I just eliminate that sentence? I don't have to read it again. Strike. With it. Yeah. In 6 months.
I'll second the strike.
Okay, so we have an amended motion that eliminates the six-month part of the motion and a second. So motion by Ms. McPherson, second by Mr. Heading. Any further discussion? None? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? None. Motion carries 5-0. Okay, great. And then that completes item C3. Janine, thanks for coming back late with us. We appreciate having you. And then we have future agenda items. Anybody? None? Then our next regular meeting will be held Tuesday, June 12, 2018 at 6 p.m. right here at the Vets Hall. And with that, meeting adjourned. Thank you.